Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, welcome to Thursday night on Dry Bones Connection. This is Antoinette, and tonight I'm so honored to have with us Marvin Waters. He is a stuntman and the founder, one of the founders of the Black Stuntman Association. And we're going to bring Mr. Walters on. He has credit so many things to his history. He started this in the 70s, and he's still active. He was in several movies as a stuntman, and there's so much to tell, but I'm going to get started with him. Mr. Marvin, good evening, and welcome to Dry Bones Connection. We're so honored to have you with us. Mr. Marvin? Okay, it's two lines. All right, let's see. Hello, Mr.
Can you
Marvin?
Hear me?
Yes, I can hear you
can
now.
You hear?
You're loud and clear.
Yeah.
Well,
all
welcome
right.
to the show. We're so honored to have you on Dry Bones Connection.
Well, I'm honored to be on. Thank you very much, Annette. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Look, you were close. Look, you do better than what a lot of folks do.
Okay.
Yeah, so I hope this opening song was appropriate for you. To me, it seemed to fit you perfectly. Sad, loud, I'm black, and I'm pride, and all the work that you did was for somebody else, and you had to change it to fit you and for other, all the other black artists that were out there that didn't get a chance, and you helped open the door so that they would have their chance, they would have their moment so that they can shine on their own.
Well, I am black and I'm proud, and I'm glad to be able to do what I did, and we'll do it again.
Well, I'm so grateful that you did. Now, can you tell us, I know I'm just jumping right in, but can you tell us how you got started doing this? You know, just being a stuntman and just opening the door for other people to do so.
Well, there was a white guy named Mickey Gilbert who was a stunt coordinator, and he had issued a call for any black man, Negroes at that time, Negro men who wanted to do stunts, to come up to his home in Sagres, California. So I was the only one to show up, and he started training me, and this is how I got started. And so
we're so glad that you did.
Yeah, well, he was doing a show called Cowboy in Africa, and he would use me on that show, and that's how I got started in the business. And Mickey, he refused to use to blacken down white guys, because at that time they would paint white guys down on white girls. Everybody would paint them down black. It was horrible looking, but Mickey refused to do that.
Yes, because I've seen where they did that with Morgan Freeman. Was it Morgan Freeman that they tried to do that with?
Oh, I don't know. There were so many guys a lot of people they did it with, that they never would say anything. But later on in the business, I think they began to start saying something about it. Because at one time, there were no black stuntmen out there, you know, prior to 1960. Well, there was one. Actually, there was a guy named Cal Brown. Cal Brown was the first black stuntman. But I consider myself the first black I was the first black professional stuntman because I came in as a stuntman. Kel Brown started as an extra, and he got his break, Devil and Bill Cosby, on I Spy. So he was actually the first black stuntman. Yeah. But I was the first professional black stuntman because I started as a stuntman for Mickey Gilbert. And so Mickey said, you know what, Marvin, you need to start a black group. He said, because there's going to be a lot of work for blacks in the future. And so this is how I got started. Yeah. That's how I got started.
Well, we're so glad that you did because, I mean, it's kind of hard to paint a black man white. I mean, to paint a white man black, for it to really be believable looking. I mean.
Yeah, well, they tried.
I'm sure they did. I mean, they got away with it with the Indians.
Yeah.
So
while
but,
on Mickey's show, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
So while I was working on Cowboy in Africa, which was Mickey's show, there was a guy named Eddie Smith. Eddie Smith, who worked he worked as an extra down on the show called a TV series called Doctari, and it was right down the road from where we were working. So he would come down sometime and work as an extra on our show. And he was a fast talker, but he knew the business a lot more than I did because he had started in like 1965, you know, knocking on doors, trying to get blacks in the business. Nobody would listen to him. So I said, Eddie Ha, I want to start a Black Stemmers Association. Would you help me? A Negro Stemmers Association, I'm sorry. I said, would you help me?
Yeah, because we were Negroes back then.
Yeah. He said, I had talked to Cal Brown a year ago, but he was not interested. He said, and I've talked to little soldiers, and they won't even talk to me. And I said, well, you know, I'm a member of the Buffalo Soldiers. Let me see if I can get you to come to a meeting. So I went back, and I talked to the Buffalo Soldiers, and they invited Eddie out to a meeting. Eddie jumped up on a table, a picnic table, and started telling them how much the money they would make as extras by starting in this business before they became stuntmen. He was in charge of hiring extras for the movie business. Basically, when they needed extras, they would call Eddie Smith. He would hire all the extras. Now, an extra on that time was making $29 a day, and I think the salary of I think it was $2. It wasn't even $2 an hour at that time, minimum wage. But you make $29.15 a day.
Yeah. So they made minimum wage to do this?
No, they were making $29.15. Yeah, $29.15 a day. And they could go in on $29.15 and maybe walk out with $500, you know, if they get different kind of adjustments. So they were happy to be in the business. So then we started the group. Yeah. The group was started with the Buffalo Soldiers, 10th Cavalry Buffalo Soldiers. They were the ones who the group was originally started with.
Now, what
That's
year
how we got
was
started
this? Now. I'm sorry, 1967. 1967.
No, it's okay.
1967,
yes.
Wow, that just doesn't seem like that. My. I mean, I would have thought that the pay would have been higher.
Oh, no, what, $29.15? The minimum wage was $2 an hour if you were working a regular job. So $29.15 was very good because number one, if you worked an hour, you worked 15 minutes. A lot of times you could just walk in the door, you don't work, and you're still going to get paid $29.15. And then you'll get adjustments and different kinds of adjustments. So they were making a lot of money. It was a lot of money to be made as an extra.
Yeah, I mean, as an extra, okay, all right. Okay, see, I misunderstood. I thought then that they were acting as a stuntman or a stunt person.
Oh, no, not yet.
Okay, that's the reason I was like, well, that's no money. I mean, we're taking a chance on getting hurt, you know. Okay.
No, they weren't stuntmen yet because we had just started training them. So meanwhile, Eddie had them working as extras while they were being trained to be stuntmen. Then when they became stuntmen, they go on a show, it was $125 a day.
Okay.
You could go in on $125 and maybe walk out with $1,000, depending on the adjustments that you got. This is why the white guys did not want blacks in the business. They were making so much money doubling the black actors.
I'm sorry, I keep cutting across you. I'm going to be quiet.
But a weekly salary at that time was $425 a week, $425 a week. And, you know, and so that was the beginning salary. You go in with $425, there's no telling how much you could walk out a day, depending on the stunt you did. So that's how we got started.
Wow. Well, what was your let me do this. Eric is with us also. Brother Eric, forgive me for not bringing you in sooner. And he's silent.
I'm enjoying it. Y'all go right ahead.
Oh, okay.
I'm listening in. I'm going to intervene here in a minute.
Okay, hey. I just didn't want to forget you.
All right. Good evening, Mr. Walters. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking.
All right. Yeah, I'm doing great, sir. I'm doing great. Thanks for asking.
Great. Well, you know, the last show I did a show, I think, about a week or two ago, and I talked for 2 hours. I'm not going to do that this time. I'm going to let you guys ask some questions, and hopefully somebody will call in and ask some questions because there's so much information that I have that I can go on, you know, but I'm not going to do that. If people want to ask questions, I am here. Ask me some questions, and I'm there.
Okay, well, y'all heard him. If you have a question or a comment, press the number 1, and I will be happy to open up your line so that you can address Mr. Walters with your questions and comments. Okay, so before they do, go ahead. Go ahead, Brother Eric.
All right. Mr. Walters, you have a good friend in the business named Antonio Fargas. How did you meet Antonio Fargas?
Oh, I started over with Antonio Fargas. We were doing a show called Across 110th Street. And Antonio, I doubled him on that show, got my hip all messed up because the actor I was working with was supposed to throw me on a breakaway table, and he threw me on the wrong table. So, but that's how I met him. So I doubled him on Starsky and Hutch. I doubled him on several shows after that. So, and we became very friends, very close. We're very close.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know, he's a legend in our community for that movie, I'm Gonna Get You Sucker. When he got out of jail, he had the Fish Aquarium shoes on.
Oh, well, that's who that is. Okay,
yeah.
I
we can't never
that.
Forget that. Man.
Yeah, he was the pimp.
You cannot meet a nicer person. You know, we started a film festival here in Galveston, Texas, and me and three or four other people. So our first film festival was year before last just before the epidemic. So he was our guest. We honored him, and he came down to Galveston and spent a week with us and at the film festival. So that was really nice, and we were going to do it again this year, but with the virus and things going on, we weren't able to do it. But he said he's willing to do it next year. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good. And hopefully we'll be over this mess soon.
I have another off-the-grid question. Back when Muhammad Ali and George Foreman fought in Africa, and you seen Spinner from the Black Bottoms, you seen James Brown, Bill Withers, all these people over there, it's such a big event. What was the vibe like around where you were at the time? And, what was the feeling, was it some kind of big uplift movement going on with the black community back then when y'all seen Muhammad Ali about to fight George Foreman in Africa?
It's always been a movement. Even when I was a kid in Detroit, it was always a movement. So I didn't spend much time around Detroit. I used to hitchhike out to a place called Bloomington, Michigan, and there was a guy who was doing a TV show. He was a cowboy. His name was Justice Coates. And I used to go out to his house and ride his horses. And he used to go to his library. He said, go in my library and look at some of the books in there. They have books on every race in the world. And I would read these books, And this is how I learned a lot about blacks. And then I had a white teacher later on to teach me a lot about our people. So I didn't spend much time being black and everybody telling you that you can't do something, I never believed that because I always felt that I could do anything I wanted to do. And I had people pushing me, telling me that. I had mentors that pushed me out of Detroit. So I was fortunate. And so it's amazing how black people can look at Muhammad Ali and all those different guys. There was a lot of jealousy there. For some reason, they wanted them to win, but at the same time, deep down inside, they didn't because we've been conditioned for 450 years, really, to hate each other and hate ourselves. Because people don't understand what it is we have accomplished in this world, the things that we have done in this world. So,
isn't that was it like that even for you when you were even trying to form the Stuntmen, the Black Stuntmen Association? How much, I know you went through a lot, fighting white folks, but how much did you have to go through fighting our own people to establish it and to even get black people to want to be a part of this?
Well, luckily, we already had the Buffalo Soldiers, and they had met with Eddie Smith, and they started making this money, and they really wanted to learn. So it was easier for them. But the thing is, when the white guys saw that we, I was training these guys, they came in and took some of the guys out of the group. You know, I don't want to name their names, but they took some out and put them in a group called Stunts Unlimited, which was a white group, and Stunts mm-hmm. Association, which was a white group. So they wanted to break the group up. But the thing is, the reason the group was so strong is because when we started, we had so many people. Then, so this is what they saw when you met with the studios. Even though later on in the industry, there was only like three or four of us. But when I went to a meeting, they would see what they had saw as a whole group before. So they still thought it was a lot of us, but it wasn't. You know, guys just dropped out for some reasons. And a lot of these guys out there today are millionaires.
Yeah. But, now you have filed 32 EEOC charges against the motion
yes.
picture. Now, do you care to go into, or are you put like on a silence where you can't talk about that, even though that was
they tried to do that to me. I said no. I said this is history, guys. I'm not going to set this up. So I filed 32 EEOC charges. We want a settlement agreement against Warner Brothers, Columbia Pictures, Walt Disney Studios, Paramount Pictures, Quinn Martin Productions, and 20th Century Fox. So we want 6 settlement agreements. You know, and this is opening doors for all minorities. You see, you are a minority in this business. If you were not related to someone in the business or a very close
mm-hmm.
friend, you were considered a minority. So it opened the doors for all these people. You know, and then in 1960, early 1968, I met
mm-hmm.
with the president of the Producers Association. I set up a meeting and met with him. The group met with him. So they started a training program for minorities, all the minorities, you know, because there were no minorities in the union, none, you know.
Mm.
So they started this training program for the minorities. And so that was a good start right there. So they began
yeah.
getting the movies. So now what? You take Bill Cosby in 1970 when he was doing the Bill Cosby Show in Columbia
mm-hmm.
Studios.
Yeah.
He walked out walked into Columbia, and the whole crew, everybody was white. Bill Cosby said, "Hey, wait a minute, I want some black people." They said, "Well, there's none in the union." That was true. There was none in the unions, but they had started training them because of the thing
mm-hmm.
that I had set up with. So they had started training them. So Bill Cosby said, "Hey, I'll pay a black crew to come in. You pay a white crew to stay home." He opened a lot of doors. Yeah. A lot of people don't know what he did, and he was always looking for trying to encourage black people to work. He did the best he could. But he's fighting a losing battle. We all fighting a losing battle. But you know, let's say you're fighting a losing war, because you don't lose all your battles. You win some.
That's true.
You have to pick the one. Yeah, you have to pick. But you got to pick them. You got to know how to pick your
yeah.
battle. Otherwise, you can forget it.
Yeah. That is
I had
so
a reputation.
True.
My reputation, I could call the chairman of the board at most of the studios. And could see them sometimes quicker than their presidents could, because they all knew who I was. And you know, I didn't go behind their back and try to do anything. A lot of people would wait until they did something, and then go file a charge against them. But I met with them beforehand and said, "Guys, this is what I'm going to do." I met with the Stemmers Association. I met with Stunts Unlimited. I met with all the studios. I said, "This is what I'm going to do. If you guys can't change," so
mm-hmm.
then they didn't believe it. So I did what I had to do. And it opened the doors to a lot of people.
Yes, and we're
yeah.
so grateful. Now, you said you had a, you also had a suit against Disney. Now, Disney is known for children's shows. I mean, and I remember back when I was coming up, and I can't think of the old black man's name, Uncle Ruckus, I want to say. That's probably not it. But, you know, Zippity Doodah. Uncle Remus.
Uncle
Thank
Remus.
Zippity Doodah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually.
No. Go ahead, please.
Walt Disney, he was very, very prejudiced. He didn't even have a black janitor working at his studio.
Wow.
And they were doing a movie with what the heck was that? This movie, not Uncle Remus. There was another black movie they were doing. Walt Disney came out there and saw all these black people on his movie. Now this is what I heard. I wasn't working on the movie, but I listened to some of the guys talk. So he came out and saw all these black people on the movie, and he went home and died the next day. So I don't know if that's a rumor or not, but I mean, this is what they said.
Oh,
he did not want black. He didn't want. I have no idea. He did not want blacks working. So he hadn't done anything with blacks.
Oh.
That's
and it's a shame because
is.
All of the money that, you know, I know that my children, my youngest one and my grandchildren that I spent on Disney, and to know that they have that type of history, I regret it.
Well,
now.
It wasn't just, it was all the studios. It wasn't just Disney, but I mean, it's more notable for Disney because he had Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, and all those shows that we really loved as kids. So we never would have thought he would, because they weren't prejudiced because they never showed anything but ducks and mice and things. So we didn't know how he was prejudiced at all. We never knew that.
Oh, no. And we also have a caller for you that they want to ask you a question. So I'm going to bring them in. Is that okay with you?
Yes, it is.
Okay, great. Brother Kwame. Good evening, Brother Kwame.
Good evening, and good evening to the brother. I forget
Marvin Walters.
Marvin Walters, okay.
Yes.
Marvin, it's a pleasure to hear you, bro. And, you know, you opened the door for a lot of people. And in this industry where we only had certain roles that we could play, and even Walt Disney did the thing with creating the cartoon, he had to use a black mouse. He couldn't use a white rat. It went over well. So he had to use us in there to get himself started, because you know it wouldn't look right if Mickey Mouse was a white rat with pink eyes. But anyway, what I'm trying to see. I've got a brother-in-law, and he's in the movie industry, and he did a lot with John Belushi. They did the Blues Brothers, but him and Fred Williamson did all of Fred Williamson's movies. His name was Marvin Towns.
Who?
Marvin Towns, because y'all had the same first name.
Oh no, I didn't know him.
Right. Well, he was. You know, when Fred Williamson Jim Brown and the other one, the karate guy, all of them were making Three the Hard Way and all those different movies. He was in the industry at that time. Yeah, he was black.
Jim Kelly?
Right. Jim Kelly. Yeah, Jim Kelly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the other thing I heard, and it was, I had to go back and watch it the other night, was New Jack City. And what Mario did when he created that, you know, they had a 30-year anniversary on Clubhouse, and they were talking. Everybody but Wesley Snipes was on there. And, you know, those times and that was the era after the black exploit movies. But that was the opening, you know, because we had the buffoon part in the 50s, Amos and Andy and Rochester and those type of roles. But what you came in and did when they started making the action movies is being able to put in the skills that, you know, we as a people have. So I just commend you for being a pathfinder for the way in which, you know, you've got the black associating of stuntmen. And hearing your story is these are things in which we hear, like Miss Kim talk about Motown, and her ex-husband talk about how Barry Gordy and all of them. You all are historians, and you have biographies written, but it's nothing like hearing the actual story from the people that lived the actual thing. And I was just watching ABC just did a thing on the Soul of a Nation, and they talking about Black Wall Street and this whole thing. It's funny how they wash down the story and make it sound like, oh, it wasn't that bad, you know. And that's something that we have to be able to hear what you're sharing and for to be able to have that recorded, to have actual facts that somebody's not going to come down later in history and say, well, you know, oh, it was this way for them. They had all of this great stuff done for them. No, there's struggle in it. And so you're telling your side lets us know what really happened.
Well, you know, prior to the Black Stuntmen, before, well, during the Black Stuntmen, when we were together, we also met with the studios to be able to complain about Stepping Fletchers, about maids, about Shoeshine Boys, and about Porters on Trains, and we demanded that there be more roles from African Americans, from Black, at that time. So that also changed. We changed that also. You know, that was changed because of us. That was before we started the Coalition of Black Stuntmen and Women. That was when we had the Black Stuntmen's Association. That was the black guys did that, you know.
Yeah, because even I've watched documentaries on Billy Bojangles and what he went through and you know, being able to bring in his skill in tap dance and then the Hines brothers, and then all of a sudden, you know, here comes Fred Astaire and all of them, you know, grandizing like they did. They copied what we created. So it's our generation, and I'm 70, and, you know, that generation and seeing what we came from in the 50s, because I remember the first black and white TV back in the 50s was when I was a little kid, and now looking at, well, we got these flat screens and smart TVs, and I'm going like, man, you know, to see this whole technology unfold, it's been something.
Well, did you know in 1950, I think it was 1955, 56, Nat King Cole was doing a TV show, and they wouldn't show it down south.
That.
Yeah, right. They would not show it down south. You've seen in the north.
Yeah.
So,
no, and that was par for the course, that there were certain things that didn't cross the Mason-Dixon line.
Right.
You know, there was certain music. You know, I look at the Temptations and who was it? David Ruffin. David Ruffin was born in Why Not, Mississippi. And the whole thing was is that where he came from and all of them, they could not, when they went, did the Motown thing, they had travel and went to the South. They had them divided. And then when they went back, the music in which they had been putting out, and it got so popular that they had to take down because they began to segregate. The children began to segregate and broke the segregation.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, somebody has sometimes stand up for something. But I think our biggest adversaries now are black people, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
if you look at these movie people, they have no idea how they got into this business. They think they just walked into this business. They don't realize there are a lot of sacrifices for them to get there.
A lot of people,
you know,
sacrifice their life, you know,
for
them to have these doors open. But the part that gets us so upsetting, the arrogance sometimes that these people like, you know, I this is mine because I earned this. No, your ancestors earned this door opening for you, because if you had to go through what they went through at the level you are now, they'd have took you out.
Yeah, well, it's a shame because, you know, they're doing these shows. Now, most of the white actors have their stunt coordinators, stuntmen in their contracts. The only ones I know was in somebody's contract was, what's his name? Samuel Jackson had a stuntman in his contract. Bill Duke had a stunt coordinator. But these white guys, nobody else would do that. They would hire white stunt coordinators. And some of these big-time actors today have white stunt coordinators on their show. They have white production managers and white, you know, they don't know how they got into the business. And they think if they can't do it themselves, no other black can do it.
Right.
That's the mentality a lot of us have. If I can't do it myself, no one else can do it.
Because what's his name? yeah, the Chinese actor, Jackie Chan. He does all this.
Jackie Chan.
Yeah.
Well, but see, Jackie Chan, even though he does most of his stuff, he's got a crew that goes, a Chinese crew that goes with him everywhere.
Go
with him. Yeah. They work with, he takes them wherever he goes, they go.
Right. But, and they know the routines that he do.
Right. In 1979, I went to Universal Studios because of a lawsuit, but Universal was a studio I had been working at since 1967, you know, and that home studio. I worked there all the time. I worked there, but when I filed these charges, they stopped using me. So, but the attorney that filed the lawsuit for the BSA, I mean for the EEOC charges. He set up a meeting for me at Universal Studios, and the president said, I did not know Marvin wasn't working here. So they put me on a show called the Hardy Boys. And so,
yeah, I remember that.
I remember the Hardy Boys.
None of the production managers wanted me except one production manager whom I had worked with when I first got in the business on Cowboy in Africa. And he said, yeah, I'll take Marvin. I'm glad to have him. So I went on his show.
Yeah.
And I got on that. And while I was at Universal Studios, I was able to have two black cinematographers, two black unit production managers, five first assistant directors, six black stunt coordinators, five female stunt coordinators. And I don't know how many first and second assistants that I had. They don't even know how they got in the business. But they started training them, and so they had gotten into the business. Even they had been training before them, based on what we had done earlier in the business. They had been training, but they weren't getting jobs. So Universal hired five of them, and so when whatever Universal did, the other studios followed. So it opened the doors for a lot.
Yeah, but somebody else that opened up a lot of doors, and he's not really a main limelight, but he's still alive, Sidney Poitier.
Yes,
Sidney
Poitier,
you know, opened up him and Harry Belafonte. They opened up doors in the time when, you know, the roles were being changed. When he started playing Brother John and In the Heat of the Night and those type of movies, that gave a whole different scene of acting as far as black men.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So there was a lot of changes made, you know. When I went to MGM Studios in 1976. And when I went to MGM Studios, I went there because no other stunt guy would take the job, because we had been meeting with MGM Studios because they had put out a call for a show called Logan's Run. And they had specified with the casting director, they wanted 270 extras and none of them were to be black. So we heard about it and we went out meeting with them. So after several meetings, they said, okay, what is it you guys want? So we said, well, we'd like to have a person on this lot to be able to read the scripts. And so, because since we don't play golf with these guys and who's going to hire the stunt coordinators, so they said, okay, well, we'll let you know. So they came back and said, okay, we'll tell you what. We'll hire an affirmative action consultant. We'll pay him $1,000 a month. $1,000 a month. I said, but nobody wanted to do it. Well, we can't do that. So I said, okay, I'll give up stunts and I'll take this job. I started at Universal, and then a stunt lady named J.D. David. She was working just about every day also. She gave it up to become my assistant on the show. We ended up working 60, 70, 80 hours a week sometimes. But we left, when we got in MGM, they had five black secretaries, a black director personnel, and 15 black janitors. That was it. If there was any more, I never saw them. We left there a year later. They had 151 minorities in key positions. The 15 black janitors have been reduced to seven, and another eight, they have moved into other positions. You know,
wow.
So then they told me, we'll pay you, we want to hire you, but we want you to stay home and work. Well, we didn't have computers at those days, you know, in other words, we want you off our lot. And I said, no, thank you. Thanks, but no thanks.
Right.
You know.
Well, how
and
you to work if you stayed home?
In other words, we're going to pay you to stay home. Don't do anything. We don't want you on our lot.
Yeah.
So
y'all just didn't get any work at all, and so you don't get your name out there, you don't get anything out there.
Yeah, but it changed things for them, you know. And so when I was at MGM, I was able to call the studios and get this work for the White Stunt Girls. You know, I had some meetings set up. I think there was two black in the White Stunt Girls Association. So I was able to get meetings set up with all the studios. The black writers at that time, I was able to get them to meet at all the studios, you know. So it opened a lot of doors. So that's where we are with that.
But is it true that, you know, they're saying that they had a lot of what, like they have Oscars and things for great actors and actresses, but they're saying, I've heard it said, that some of the great stuntmen that had done some of the greatest stunts were people of color.
Now they're finally beginning to open the doors for them now. They recognize them, yes. That's right.
Right.
They have great stunt guys, some black stunt guys out there. You know, Tony Brubaker, Greg Elam, Bob Miner, you know. But me, I was kind of like, I didn't get the shows they got, the big shows. They kept me working just enough to keep my mouth shut, you know. But, I mean, it was
right.
Supporting my family. I didn't get the big shows like a lot of those guys got, but I made a very good living, you know. But the thing is, when Warner Brothers called me in their office, David Lance, who was the vice president of labor relations or something, he called me in his office and said, the people upstairs told me you can have a blank check if you drop the charges against Warner Brothers and Wolper Productions. I said, Jay, it's not about the money. It's not about Marvin Walsh. It's about all those other minorities out there that can't get on this lot and get a job. I said, you tell them I will drop the charges against Wolper Productions. Warner Brothers owned Wolper Productions. But I said, I'll drop the charges against Wolper Productions, but I will not drop the charges against Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers later on violated the settlement agreement. Warner Brothers and Quinn Martin both violated the settlement agreement, and they had to pay monetary damages to all the black stunt people. Had to pay money.
Well, that's good. Now, when we had spoke earlier, you was telling me how your car was bombed in your driveway.
Well, actually, yes, it was set on fire in my driveway at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and my neighbor saw the fire and got the fire. They came just before they said this car was going to explode and probably would have set your whole house on fire, you know. And that's because the Civil Rights Commission was coming out, you know, in 2 days. And that was a threat to me. I had received letters saying that you testify with the Civil Rights Commission, that, you know, things are going to happen. So, but that's what happened. So the Civil Rights Commission came out and investigated how it would, and things changed again. As a result of Warner Brothers and Quinn Martin violating the contract, Clarence Thomas was the director of the EEOC at that time, and he sent a young lady named Marge Ryan, an attorney named Marge Ryan, came out to represent us to help to negotiate the deal between Warner Brothers and Quinn Martin for our settlement agreement.
Do you want to take a break for a moment and get some water, get something to drink to help clear your throat?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
well, I'm going to say a song while you do that so you can clear your throat.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
Same way.
Mr. Waters, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, now, I know that that song means something to you. Do you want
yes,
to share
does.
That memory with us?
Yes, I do. That
okay.
song was James McEachin. James McEachin, I understand from him now. I don't know how true it is, but he used to be a producer with Motown, and he was a producer with Martha Reeves and the Vandellas. And he left to go into the motion picture business, and they wrote that song for him. This is what I understand. But anyway, Jimmy Mack was a hell of a writer. He had a contract. And first of all, Jimmy Mack and Steven Spielberg used to write together. They had Universal used to have an abandoned motel across the street from their studio that they used for guests and things.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Mack, McEachin, and Steven Spielberg were writing over there, and they had telephone service and everything, and Universal didn't even know they were doing it.
Wow.
And then when they found out about it, they invited them on the lot. And James McEachin, he wrote a show called one of the shows he wrote was called Shaka Zulu. He had a contract to produce, write, direct, and write.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote this script called Shaka Zulu. They told him they would never, ever do a show that powerful.
Wow.
And somebody else ended up doing it years later, but this was in like 1979.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. And they said, you'll never do a show like that. But later on, somebody else did it. He wrote that. He made sure Blacks was on his show all the time also when he was working, you know. And so he did a show called Ten of Flies. He was a detective with a TV series called Ten of Flies. I don't know how well it made it, but anyway, I doubled him on that show, and he made sure I was with him all. Yeah. So, yeah, Jimmy Mack, he was one hell of a man. Or he is. I think he's still alive. I don't see anything in the IMDb about his death, so I assume he's still alive, but he's one hell of a man, a writer, very good writer.
Yes, wow. We were trying to get Miss Martha Reeves, but I don't know if the word got to her or not, but we tried. We did reach out to try. And I sent her an email as well, but I know she only checks her email when she goes to her office.
Okay. So anyway, that's where that was. Yep.
Well, so, I mean, I know that not only do you have your work is also tied in with your background with being in Detroit, and it was influenced by Motown as well.
Yes, it was, basically, yes. Because, actually, Motown is, they're related. My uncle was married to Berry Gordy's. A lot of my older relatives were related to Mary Lucy, related to a lot of the Gordys, because we used to go up to his mother's house. I think they used to call her Big Mama, and she used to go used to take us up to Idlewild, Michigan. Idlewild, we'd go up there. And, you know, it was a resort time, and we'd go up there with her. They had property up there. And so we used to go up there. So, yeah.
See, so that was good. I tell you, I don't know what they did to Detroit, but y'all were really something back then.
Yeah. Well, you know, Kim Weston, is it Weston? Weston?
Yes,
Kim?
Weston, yes.
We lived on the same street, and I didn't know it until I talked to her last week. My address was 1824 Chestnut Street, and hers was 22-something Chestnut Street. I said, what?
Yeah, that
from
was something.
And we didn't know each other, yeah.
Yeah,
we
y'all be so close and go to the same school, and y'all just missed each other.
Yeah,
so was the streets that big? Were they that long? Or?
I lived between Orleans and St. Albans, but there was a railroad track between me. Between St. Albans and Orleans, so I lived between the railroad track and Orleans. Then on the other side was the railroad track in St. Albans, and then St. Albans, there was another street, and then Shane, so she lived on Shane. So, yeah. It was a long street. You didn't, you know, territorial, very territorial.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Yeah.
Because that's just something y'all were so close into. And especially by y'all being, you know, close to the same age. That y'all missed each other.
Yeah. Well, you know, most of my time, like I said, I didn't spend that much time in Detroit. You know, I spend my time out in the suburbs. So
yeah.
that's where I just, Detroit was not for me. I had a lot of mentors in Detroit, but as far as Detroit, that just was not for me. You know, so I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to work in a factory because, you know, but a lot of guys, that's what they want to do, and I can understand that. That was not my thing. I wanted to do something else with my life, and I knew I had to get out of Detroit to do it. And
yeah,
I had a lot of support.
Well, it worked for both of y'all. Miss Kim, you know, she was a famous singer, and you are a famous actor, a famous stuntman
okay.
that opened the doors. I mean, both of y'all were back at that time where y'all opened doors. You know, y'all made ways for other people.
But you know what, Antoinette, I think that, you know, if you're going to get out there and fight, it can't be about you.
No.
And, you know, if you're out there fighting and it's going to be about you, you can forget it. You know, if you're going, what can I get this, you know? And that was one of the problems with me and Eddie Smith, because Eddie Smith was always what he was going to get out of something. I didn't care. It was never about me. I think I've got three pictures in my house. I got James McKeithen. I got Richard Roundtree, and I got Lou Gossett. Those are the only three pictures I have. I tell people all the time, do not introduce me as a stuntman. That's not who I am. That's my job.
Yes.
That's my job, you know. And you have to separate what you do from who you are.
Yeah,
and I learned that a long time, you know. And I
knew
if I would have taken that deal at Warner Brothers, I wouldn't have been able to do anything for anybody. You know, that would have been it.
Yeah, that's true.
Could I ask a question?
Yes, go ahead, Brother Kwame.
Yeah, I was just looking up because I'm always looking up information. And they were talking about the Black Stuntmen Associations and their meeting in Athens Park. I was out there in California. When they were given some type of award they gave, and they're listing the different for Black History Month in Los Angeles City Hall. And they were talking about Melvin Jones, Phyllis Linda, Ellis, Alex Brown, William J. Lipton, Albert Lord, and...
You didn't see Marvin Walsh's name anyway. You didn't see Marvin Walsh's name in the Smithsonian Institute. And the reason for that is, I'm going to tell you right now, 1968, we were doing a show with the Supremes, Ben Cosby and the Supremes. So Eddie Smith went out and made a deal with Paramount Studios that he was going to get these Black stunt guys, and he couldn't get them, but he came to me, but we were in the same group together. So I went out, and he said, well, how are we going to do this to get these guys to work? I went out and had a meeting with the Screen Actors Guild, with Ken O'Fady at the Screen Actors Guild, and we got a waiver so these guys would be able to work on that show. Now, Eddie Smith was going to pay these guys $50 for doing stunts. So I asked Eddie, I said, hey, we need to get a stunt budget. Did you get a stunt budget? No, he's been in the business longer than I had. But I had been in the business straight, being trained by Mickey Gilbert and was learning about stunt budgets and production and things. So this is when I left the group after that, because these guys were doing stunts, and I had two of my friends two of the white guys that I had worked with for a while. They were out there, and they said, you know what, these stunts, Ernie Robertson went through a breakaway window on one side, came out into a saloon, and came out a breakaway window on the other side for $50. I said, Eddie, that's not fair. But everybody was looking for somebody to follow. They didn't want to follow me because I would go out. Every meeting they had, I set up at all the studios for them. Then they tried to steal my logo. So you know, that's just another story. So they don't recognize me at all. In fact, they tried to tell people I was never a member of the Stuntmen's Association. But I have a letter from Mickey Gilbert. Yeah, I have a letter from Mickey Gilbert, the guy who trained me, and he was telling. He says, "No, Marvin's the only guy I knew that came up here. He was the one who started this group." He said Eddie Smith worked, but Eddie Smith was more of an actor. He said, Eddie Smith used to come and complain to me, well, why don't you have some black guys working on your show? And he said, Eddie said, find me some black guys. And Eddie didn't find any black guys until I got with Eddie Smith and said, hey, we need to start this group. But, you know, it doesn't bother me. You know, so a lot of people say, well, aren't you mad at those guys? I said, no. How can you be mad at somebody who's been dissing for 450 years to do that to you? No, I'm not mad at them. They came out to the studio. They got together and came out to Universal Studios and said, we can do a better job than Marvin. Now, at this time, I got like six stunt guys out there, six black stunt guys with me. They came out and said they could do a better job than we could. Now, at this time, they had not been working before prior to me being at Universal. While I was at Universal, we were doing like 19 shows. Every white stunt coordinator out there had to have a minority on this show, had to have one. And I would be down where we used to leave from the makeup department. I would be there. When they saw me, they would get on the phone and make sure they got called somebody. So they were working all the time then. For some reason, they felt they needed to be in charge. So that's when I said, okay, y'all guys can have it. I left in 1981, and the business went right back to where it was.
And you have all this in your book.
Pardon?
I'm sorry. You have all this in your book?
Yes, I do.
And can you tell us the name of your book?
Awakening Giant, but you can't buy it anywhere. In order to get it, you have to if somebody wants a copy of the book, if they would email me, I'll send them a copy of the manuscript and the cover of the book. Because you can't buy it anymore.
Oh.
Yeah, the whole history of the Black Feminist Association, and it's documented. And, you know, there's some people living today will tell you, no, Marvin did this. You know, I can give you their names if you want them, you know, and left it. And Marvin was the one who created this. So they got to the point. Some people, like I tell people, a lot of people like who follow Jim Jones over there. Took all those people out of the country, and this is what they did, you know. Because I was always honest with the studio. I said, "This is what I'm going to do." They were waiting until somebody did something, then they wouldn't go have them fired. That's too late to do anything. Get it done before then. So we was able to open the doors by being honest and being upfront.
Yeah, because that's not where how you can do it. Yes.
Well, I came to Galveston in 1989. I was working on a show. Directly second unit, the coordinator on the show. And the police was riding around in a white van with hoods on, and they were taking black guys off the street. You know, I don't really remember what they were taking them for, and putting them in this van. So then this was for several days. So I called and got the FBI to come in undercover and break it up. I did start a group called the Galveston County African American Coalition, which changed a lot of things out here. That's just who I am. That's what I do. That's what I do. And I don't seek recognition for it. I just do it. And the group was doing very well until people decided, well, they wanted me to do all the work. I said, I can't do it. I can't do it. The door's open. Run with it.
Yes.
And that's the same
thing
in Hollywood.
Do you think it's still like that today?
Where, in Galveston? Oh,
well, the film industry, just in the entertainment industry in general, is it? I mean, I notice now you see more people, even now the Emmys and everything are open to where, you know, you're seeing black artists. And, I mean, it seemed like it was a fight to even have that for the Grammys.
It was a fight. It wasn't easy. It's always been a fight, you know. But when I tell people, I get calls nowadays sometimes from Hollywood. I said, you know, you guys, the charges that we won, the settlement agreements that we won, are still in force. Use them.
Yeah.
Can you come back in? Not come. Hell, I'm 82 years old. I'm not coming back there and fight your battles for you. I'll tell you how to do it. You got to fight for yourself. I open the doors for you. But the thing is, the doors that I open for the people that the generation under me, right under me, who open the doors, they didn't go down and help anybody else.
Right. That doesn't do any good.
Doesn't do any good. Doesn't do any good. You look at some of these big actors out there. You know, Ice-T. What's he got on his show? White coordinators. Most of these black actors got white stunt coordinators on their shows.
Yeah.
And stunt coordinators
$6,000 a week.
Well, what about Tyler Perry? Do you know?
I really don't know much about Tyler Perry. You know, I've never been in contact with him. I don't know what he does. I don't know who's on his shows because I don't keep up with the business that much anymore. I just know sometimes I go look. I'll see a show and I go look and go into items and look see who the stunt coordinator is with him. And, you know, it was the same thing. Some of these black actors that you see, you can take the world of, same thing.
Yeah, but now the cowboy movies, the ones where, you know, they show the black cowboys, do they use something or are they just good at both? Do you know?
The black movies they did?
With the black cowboys. I mean, I've seen one last night, Concrete Cowboys, about the black cowboys in Philadelphia.
Oh, no, I don't know. I didn't know that. But I do know that the black cowboys, the black cowboy shows that I knew about did have black stunt coordinators on them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, no, I don't know. I just know you need to
Not everyone can ride a horse.
But you know what you, Antoinette, you talking about the Concrete Cowboys.
Yes.
A lot of those, they showed at the end, they'll show you on the end of that. A lot of those people, those were the actual people. That was a true documentary about that and how they took, you know, that they had on the north side of Philadelphia, they had black cowboys, guys that kept their horses and did. But this was a true story on how they tried to shut them down from having them riding horses in the city of Philadelphia. And what's his name? Ibris. I forget his name, but he was star. But it was about, you know, the thing that it was about, a mother had to give up her son in order for him to learn how to become a man.
Right, and he was from Detroit.
Right.
The son was from Detroit.
Right. Yeah, they were from Detroit. But the other part was is that the other thing that they showed in there, too, because the guy that was in the wheelchair, he was horses, what we used to use horses when we had people coming out with PTSD. Horses are prey animals, and they know when something's wrong with a person. That's why he let his son go out there that when that horse was acting wild.
Yeah, to break
had
the
to
horse.
His son, right. Well, it wasn't to break his. He had to be the one because the guy that was originally that was riding that horse before went away from him, and the horse got upset with it. And so what it was when he learned. The horse said that he had a problem, so I need to help fix him if you can help fix and take care of me. Because that was the whole thing about that inner exchange and the horses teaching men how to be men and women how to be men and women.
Yeah.
Horses do that.
Yeah. My uncle had horses and I'm sorry, go ahead.
I had my first horse when I was 6 years old, bought him for $1. In Detroit.
Wow.
What happened, there was a man named Mr. Coffee, and he used to deliver wood and coal and you know, all on his way. And I used to work with him, help him, you know. So he was coming down the street one day, and I wasn't working. I said, Mr. Coffee, I said, will you sell me that horse? And all the neighbors out there, oh, yeah, I'll sell you this horse for $1, boy. I was running in the house, begging my mother for it. That was $1 was a lot of money. She gave me $1 without. And Mr. Coffee, he said, well, all right, even though he capped the horse, but I could go down and ride the horse anytime I wanted to it because I still work for him, you know. So, but that's when I started riding. That's how I got started, riding horses. And rode horses until I came to Texas. I had horses in California to come out of Texas. And then I had about a few of them, you know, that I take care of. But other than that, that was it. But I love horses.
I rode it a couple of times, and I was a whole lot younger. I don't even think, I think I was a teenager. But my uncle had them, so.
Me and the guy in Will Dawson. was Will Dawson was from Detroit. Will Owens was the name of Detroit, but he became got in the motion picture business. I got him in the motion picture business as a driver, and he changed his name to Will Dawson. But William Owens was his name, and we used to skate at the Arcadia Roller Rink in Detroit, and we grew together. We used to ride rodeos together at junior rodeos, you know, out at the state. Yeah, so we grew up together, and then he died about 10 years ago. But I got a picture business also.
Yeah, okay, we have another caller. You have another caller
right
with
ahead.
Your hand up, if you're ready.
I'm sorry, what was that, Eric?
You have someone else with their hand up, if you're ready.
Oh, I'm ready, yes.
Okay. Area code 347. Area code 347.
Peace, y'all. Can y'all hear me?
Yes, we can. You're loud and clear.
Yes, this is Thomas in New York. I wanted to say thanks for having the show tonight.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah, I was just listening to an interview, and it was somebody saying that their father was one of the founders of the Union for the Black Stuntmen in Hollywood, and that's how they got their job in Hollywood, and I can't even think of who it was, man. But I was shocked. I do have a question though, and it's two questions, but it's kind of long. I want to premise it. Today with the technology, you got streaming apps. NBC got Peacock, CBS got Paramount app, Disney got Disney Plus, you got Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime TV, Apple TV. You got a bunch of the Google Chrome TV. Streaming seems like it's giving opportunities for blacks to make their own movies without the Hollywood studios. Do you think that's true, brother?
That is true. That's true. Because, I mean, those are business people, and they're not hooked up like Hollywood people were. Hollywood people, if you didn't know film, they really didn't want to hire you. But nowadays, if you got connections with somebody, it's a lot easier to go to one of these. But you don't. The thing is, they don't make movies. They make them a lot cheaper. You know, I have a script that I wrote that I want to get done, and it's like $15 million. You know, but being in Hollywood, I've got lost all of my connections. If I was still in Hollywood, I could get it made. But being here in Texas, you know, out of sight, out of mind, you lose the connections. But I'm still working with some people to get it made. And it's a hell of a good script.
And that's my second part. My second part, right? It appears that today, with the streaming technology, they're taking movies out of the theaters and bringing them direct to people's homes. There's been a few movies that came out this year that just went straight to HBO Max or went straight to, you know, Disney Plus. Do you think that's going to affect the money black people make in Hollywood, being that they're not going to get the box office?
It affects all of us because it affects our residuals, you know. I mean, the residual effect is not what it used to be. You know, you used to get residuals. But like the first three times when you worked on a show, whatever you made on that show, the first three times it was showing, you got the same whatever you made on that show. Now I don't even know what the residual factory is anymore. It's down to almost nothing now. There's a lot of complaints about it. So, I mean, I still get residuals, but not as much as I used to get, you know. But I still get them. I get residuals for a penny sometimes. I say, my gosh, it costs more to mail it to me. But, you know, I still get residuals.
Wow.
But, you know, you're in New York. Were you in New York when they did Seismic Score?
Hello, I'm sorry, when they did what?
Seismic Score, Richard Roundtree, in 1972?
I was born in 1977, brother.
Okay, sorry about that. Yeah, no, I was in
New York. I will say this, though. They are filming up here, right, in Harlem. They're filming Forrest Whitaker playing Bumpy Johnson, and it's the Godfather of Harlem. So I do see, like, they'll park all the old cars around and have them, you know, sitting out so they could shoot a scene here or there. But, that's the only movie I've seen getting shot up here or any show.
I did Across the 110th. That's where Antonio Fargas worked with me. I worked with him on that, Across the 110th. and then I did Chef Big Score, and I did something called Sisters in New York. And then yeah, when I left New York, I said, I'll never go back. That's simply because I got there. I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks, and I ended up being down there for like four months, staying in the same hotel. I said, no, this is not for me. So, no.
Oh, wow.
But it was too bad, but I wanted to get away from them.
But Brother Thomas, is he still on?
Yes, Brother Thomas.
Yeah, Peace Squad.
Yeah, but now, did you were a lot, you were, because you came in 77, so 82, I think, in 80-something was when they did New Jack City, 91. It had to be around 90, in the 90s, because they just had the 30th anniversary.
Yeah, I grew up in Jersey City, New Jersey. I moved to Harlem 20 years ago. So I didn't remember. When I saw New Jack City, I was living in Jersey City.
Right. But what they were talking about, that was when the crack was the epidemic there. And when they were shooting the movie, they said that the all the time that they were shooting the movie, that the crack sales went down. Because everybody that was using crack was there watching them film the movie and doing different, trying to get acting parts in the movie. And so they were saying how it affected the drug sales while they were making the movie.
Wow. Well, that was good.
Well, you know what? I could see that happening because when they make a movie, they have a lot of cops around. You know what I'm saying? So they probably had a lot of drug dealers outside, you know, trying to sell them. But I was just watching the other day another Spike Lee movie where they was talking about crack a lot. It was Jungle Fever. And I think that that was actually a dynamic movie, man. It was very good. But Samuel Jackson played the hell out of the crackhead, man. Him and Halle Berry. That was her first role.
Yeah, but the part that was about Wesley Snipes playing and that was Spike was that when he made New Jack City, all the actors, all the dark melanated actors got jobs because everybody wanted to see a dark actor in the movies. And if you notice, after New Jack City, a lot of dark melanated actors start playing main roles.
Well, Mr. Walters, we want to thank you for that because we know you opened the door so that was able to happen.
Well, yeah, I thank everybody, you know, but like I said, you got to do what you got to do because, you know, and, you know, all the while I was in the business, I mean, I knew there was guys who was using drugs, but they never used them on my show. And the only thing I know is I've never seen anybody use it. And nobody's ever, all the while, nobody's ever offered me any. I never said I didn't use them, but nobody's ever offered me any. And so I respect them. And if they wanted to do it on their show, you know, that's what they would do. They would go into their trail and they would do it. But on my show, none of them would. They wouldn't do it on my show. But and I never said don't do it. I guess they just respected me enough not to do it.
Yeah. So that was good. That was a good thing. That truly was.
I smoked a joint in 1960, and I said, I don't think anybody can put this in their system, but that was me. That was just me. Now, I've got a whole lot of friends. They lived on this stuff, you know, but I said, no, I just couldn't do it, you know.
Well, yeah, I know a lot of people that do it, but, you know, that's them, and people do what they do.
That's right.
I got introduced to heroin when I went to Vietnam in 1969. And that's where the crack came from because all the brothers there was using heroin. It was 98% pure. You couldn't shoot it. So what we had to do was we had to put it in the tip of the cigarette and smoke it.
Wow.
That's where the whole concept of crack came from, being able to smoke it as opposed to, you know, snort it because you couldn't even snort the because the Ho Chi Minh Trail was the drug trade. That was what was going on in Vietnam. That and Clark Oil had discovered oil in Vietnam, and this was the pathway to Turkey to send the drug. That's why they made the movie The French Connection. The French Connection was the French had gotten into the heroin trade, and this is what was supplying to the heroin supply to New York.
Oh, I always thought Vietnam is where they brought the marijuana from.
No, marijuana grew in Vietnam, just like you see forests of trees.
Yeah.
You see big old fields of bamboo. That's what marijuana grew like in Vietnam.
Yeah, I remember a lot of people that came back. They seemed to be, you know, they were marijuana. They were smoking marijuana.
Well, marijuana was the thing. You could take a carton of cigarettes and trade it off for heroin and plus some extra money, because what they would do with the cigarettes, tobacco was worth more. They would repack the cigarettes and seal the packages back up and sell them to you. On the street corners, you could buy Marlboros Kools, and I don't think Newports was out, but I know the black always smoked Kools, so they didn't pack the Kools, but you buy your pack of Marlboros, and it was marijuana with the filters on. But that's why you had to learn that when you buy cigarettes, you open them from the bottom to make sure it's tobacco in there and not marijuana.
Oh, is that still today?
Well, I used to when I smoked, and I would always, people, why you open your cigarettes from the bottom? I said, because I have to check to see if they, and I would tell them the story about they would repack the cigarettes with marijuana, because we got a lot of guys got busted because they bought some cigarettes on the street and didn't know that they were packed with marijuana.
Boy. That's dangerous. Wow. Oh, my. Whew.
Mr. Walters,
can I ask you, I got to take this call. Okay, just a moment. Ms. Kim.
Yes, ma'am. Blessings, everybody. Thank you. Blessings, everybody. Mr. Walter, hey, how are you doing, sir?
Fine. How you doing, Kim Weston? Good to hear your voice.
I'm blessed. Yeah, I'm blessed. I'm listening. I'm listening to Go ahead.
Let me ask you a question, Kim. You say you went to Bronson, right?
Uh-huh.
Did you have a principal there named Mr. Billups at that time?
I believe so.
Yeah, he would whoop you with that paddle with the holes in it.
Yeah, but he never hit me.
I was there for half a semester. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, Mr. Billups was his name. I remember him. Because he took my butt up. I said, I got to get out of here.
Y'all had that too in Detroit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we used to have that in Chicago. Miss Hattie Brown had one that the wood shop teacher would make for her, and she had holes in it. And she had written on there, the Board of Education.
Oh, my parents bought a paddle from a store, from a restaurant that had the Board of Education. Lord, I think I had that paddle broke on my butt. Because I was, the only girl, but I was the one who just the mouthiest and everything else. I was determined to have the last word.
I come from the generation of children being seen and not heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that too.
Okay. But
I still try it now, but they don't listen.
I wanted to
say
that.
It wasn't no such thing. It wasn't no such thing as a timeout.
Nope.
Well, we grew up. We sit around and we learned a lot from listening to the elders talk. We learned a lot about our history of that time, you know, and a lot about what you should do and can't do. You know, these kids nowadays, hell, they know everything. They know more than you'll ever know and don't know nothing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, that is so true. I'm sorry, Ms. Kim, you were saying?
I just wanted to say that Ms. Poole was my kindergarten teacher. Ms. Brewer was the first black principal in the city of Detroit, in Black Bottom. And I hear you talking about your mentors. Were most of your mentors in the suburbs, Mr.
Hello? Me, Kim Marvin?
Walter?
Uh-huh.
No.
I'm talking about your mentors. Where were most of your mentors?
Most of my mentors?
Uh-huh.
They were in Detroit. They were in fact, two of them, there was a set of twins that lived down the street on Chestnut. I can't think of their name, but they lived down down the street on Chestnut. And they became, one of them became a general, another became a, I think both became generals in the Army, you know. They being bored with their nicknames. They lived down the street on Chestnut on the other side of the bridge. And so, they were my two of my mentors. And Harold McClung, who became a doctor, was one of my mentors. And Demi McClung, who became an engineer, was one of my mentors. My biggest mentor was a white teacher named Mrs. Magny when I left Detroit, when I was in Detroit, when I changed schools and went to Bishop Elementary School. She was the one who locked her doors to teach us about Africa, about the Egyptians. She said, you came from the greatest race of people there ever was, the African and the Egyptian.
Wow.
You know, and so, yeah, oh, yeah, she said, but the Egyptians are, she said, no, the Egyptians came from the foot of the mountain of the moon, which is Mount Kilimanjaro. That's where they came from, Mount Kilimanjaro. They went into Egypt because of the fertile soil.
Excuse me, we have a lot of background noise, y'all. Could you mute your lines if you're not speaking, please, so that way it doesn't interfere with the show? Oh, please. Thank you. I'm sorry, y'all.
No, that's okay. I learned a lot from her. I learned a lot from that lady. And she said, you know what? I bought you a book that's down in the library. I said, go get it. The Long Third Voice. So I went and got the book. She said, read it. I read the book. She said, well, what you get? I said, well, he discovered it. She said, read it again. She said, read page 6. On page 6, it said Columbus, when he got over to the West Indies, the Indian people told him that an African race had been coming there for 1,000 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have two questions. Miss Kim had one of her mentors when she was in high school, and that was Mr. Sterling. Did you have Mr. Sterling in high school as well?
No, I knew Mr. Sterling. I dropped out of high school, but everybody knew Mr. Sterling. Mr. Sterling was well known. He was well known. So, no, I had to get out of Detroit, and that was my way out. I said, I got to go. I've got to go. And I'm glad I did, you know. And I don't know. I went back to visit the project last January. Last year, I went back to Detroit to a funeral and went to see the projects where I used to live. And they're gone now, but the project is still there. It's just a new brand of projects. Us
all. Yeah.
Project.
That's everywhere.
Yeah. They're designed to keep you in. That's the way it was. But
yeah.
If you don't want to, you know what I've learned, Mrs. Magnuson, she said, you know what? Your mind is just like doing gymnastics. She said, your head, your body's going to follow your head.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever you want to go, your body's going to follow your head. So if you get your mind somewhere else. And she said, thinking is the most powerful thing you will ever do. And she would teach me, she said, look around this room. See what the teacher's like. Hey, what do you see? Everything in this room was thought of before it was invented. Thinking is the most powerful thing. You know. So that's why.
Yeah, it always starts with a thought.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Thought, the word, and the deed. So that's the way I was raised, you know. People used to think I was different because I used to run around Detroit with a cowboy hat on and a rope.
you were a cowboy.
Listening to hillbilly music. That's right. I was kind of strange, but you know, I understood where my people were, and that's one thing I did understand. You know, where are we and where can we go?
Yeah, and that's something that we're lost now. You know,
Yes.
We're lost. We don't have too many people that think that way or that really want to help our people because they're too busy trying to figure out what are they going to get out of it.
Yep. Yep.
And it just doesn't work that way.
You know,
as you know and as Miss Kim knows, you know, for the sacrifice that Miss Kim made when she did Lift Every Voice. You know, it's...
Yep, that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just not appreciated. I mean, I hate to say it's not appreciated, but...
It's not recognized.
I mean, when you look at the sacrifice, yeah, and not appreciated, too, but...
Yeah, right.
You know,
you
got to
recognize it before you can appreciate it. You know,
yeah,
nobody
that
wants
is
to
so
recognize.
True.
Yeah.
And people
and
just think
you know,
that it's just automatically just always been there, and it hasn't for everything.
Yeah.
You know, for us as a people, we're growing on the backs of someone else.
Yes, that's what it is. And the thing is, you know, you that thing, pay it for it. You got to pay it for it. And we don't do that. You know, like
no,
I said, it was never about Marvin Walters. It never has been about me. And so, and you know, anybody you talk to will say, it was never about me. In fact, I'm writing a script. I just finished writing a script, and I'm talking to a guy now who lives in Hawaii. He was a stunt coordinator, and he was just
mm-hmm.
telling me that he said you helped me so much. He's a heck of a writer. So he's helping me make some changes to my script. And he said, Marvin, I'm glad to help you anytime because you've helped so many people. You know, and I said, well, you know, I don't like using the I, but you know, if people don't know what you did, and I have an egotistical thing with me, but the way things are now, people need to know how they got to where they are.
Yes.
You know, they
need
to know.
How many people do you think that are in Hollywood that are acting now that truly do not recognize that you are the reason why they're there, why they had that opening?
Well, most of the black actors out there, the majority of them are. And if you look at some of the work that they did, you can see, what have they done? You know, what have they done?
Well, Morgan Freeman, and at one time Wesley Snipes was really a popular actor, where he did a lot of movies. Where did he have a stuntman?
Oh yeah, he had a stuntman. His last name was Ward, I think. He kept blacks on his show too. Wesley Snipes, Wesley Snipes. What's the guy? We mentioned his name. Who started Wesley Snipes? What was his name? The big black director now. He said Wesley Snipes worked in his first movie. What was his name? We mentioned his name earlier.
Spike Lee.
Spike Lee, yeah. Spike Lee. He's going to make sure blacks are on his show. But I'm not going to tell you anything about them, the Washington and some of those other guys. You know, it's like they are, you know, hopefully they've changed. But they, like I said, if a white person can't do it, a black person can't, if they can't do it themselves, another black can't do it. I remember Clint Eastwood was doing a show called The Eiger Sanction. He went to Switzerland to do this movie. The stunt coordinator never left town. It was under contract. Never left town and got paid every week. This is by being in this contract. Blacks need to learn to take care of blacks. We need to learn that. We need to learn that. And we don't learn it. And we have to pay it for it. When we consider, you know, and we need, and people, blacks got to learn to ask for help. It's not, don't be embarrassed to ask for help. Well, people don't think, if you don't ask for help, people think you don't need help.
Yeah, but sometimes they take when you ask for help as a weakness.
No, I know that's what I'm saying. You got to be careful who it is you ask. You know, a lot of people take it for weakness.
Well, on that note, may I say, on that note, I went to Reverend Jackson and told him what was happening to me in Hollywood. I couldn't get anything because they said, you got to have some film or something. And he went to Bill Cosby. And in 2 days' time, I did a show with Bill, the Green-Eyed Monster. And I heard you when you were talking about Bill. And I want to ask for help right now because I'm working on a veterans and community coalition for us to take care of ourselves. And I appreciate any help. You're talking about the Buffalo Soldiers. I'm an honorary Tuskegee Airman. So any way that you can suggest for me to get the Buffalo Soldiers, the Tuskegee Airmen, and any other veterans and anybody from the community that want to help us get Bill Cosby out of jail. Bill has done much more for the world than any of those other people that they have pardoned. Bill does not need to be in jail. The veterans
Bill
step
never
up to get anything.
Bill never should have went to jail. I mean, if he did what they say he did, he should have been in a hospital somewhere, not in jail. But being that he was black and it was so powerful, they had to set and make an example out of him. He never should have been in jail. That makes
no sense.
Well,
they said it was because he wanted to buy NBC. But also, when I was doing research about it, I seen it also had to do with a pipeline that they wanted to run in Massachusetts through his, I think some of it was going through his property and things like that. And he refused, and he helped fund the
Indians,
protesters from them, you know, able to do it. You know, they kept blocking it. So
yeah.
They think, I mean, anytime they're going back and bringing up charges from the 60s, you know, 60
yeah.
years old and things like that.
Yeah, I had Bill Cosby. I kept his horses at my house in Altadena, California. I kept up his horses. When he bought them, he was going to do a Western movie. He never did it, but, you know. I went with them to buy the horses, and I kept them for almost 2 years, I think.
Mm.
But, yeah. You know, but
they've got him for release on September the 25th this year.
Well, that's,
he doesn't need to be in there all the time.
No, he doesn't, especially by him being sickly and elderly. And,
right.
You know, and then he's blind, so what in the world is he going to do? Who is he a threat to?
Right.
Well, I'm
– But what he –
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it's like Antoinette was saying, because he's an example. Anytime that a black man stands up and begins to say that we want to be productive, they have to shut him down.
Yep.
And I'm saying if we come together and say something, they'll have to let him out.
I think
yeah.
that's what it takes. You know, we just need to come together and write letters. So I'm willing to do it.
Right. But what we have now is a movement, you know, the Me Too movement and the other movements, and now the younger people are looking at, okay, these things that older people are doing, then we need to stop this. But you still have the same pedophilia and the whole system in the European society as opposed to what's happening in the black society. And the
mm-hmm.
thing of it is that you're seeing, you know, all of these people, Bill Clinton's still out, and
yeah.
he did what he did there in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's right.
And a whole lot more.
He wasn't the only one.
No, he wasn't.
Oh, there is.
He definitely wasn't.
No, he's not the only one, but.
No, I said that one, that episode that he did was not his only one.
No. Because he was a Rhodes Scholar, and when he went to Oxford, over there to Oxford, he had a rape case over there, and they sent him back and took his scholarship.
Oh, wow. And he still managed to become president and everything.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, at this time, when they're taking, even, I mean, now that what I know about Disney now, I can appreciate that, you know, but still, Pepe Le Pew, and they said because he was, you know, kept making advances to the cat.
Right.
I mean, you know, I'm like, okay, I mean, but, you know, it's a cartoon, Pepe Le Pew.
Hey, is Eric still on? Eric Ferris, are you still on?
Yes, he
Eric.
Is. Eric's
well,
quiet.
He has a question. No, he wanted to ask me a question. What did you want to ask me, Eric?
I wanted to ask you about being in Cooley High. about how that came about and where you finished with. I mean, were you pleased with the finished product? Because man, we all love that movie right there.
Yeah.
We love Cooley High.
Cooley High was filmed in Chicago, right? There was a black mm-hmm. director on the show. His name was what the hell was his name? Gosh, I can't think of his name. But anyway, we're doing the show. And come to find out, he thought he had 2 weeks to do a car chase. And I came to him, I said, hey, man, they're getting, because I was in, one of the white guys told me they're going to pull a plug on them. I went and I told him, I said, then they're getting ready to pull a plug on you. So Michael Schultz, I said, Michael, they're going to pull a plug on you. You got 2 days to film this car chase. He said, I can't film it in 2 days. He went back and told the people what I said. They still told me, you got 2 days to do it. It cost me a lot of jobs, but I told him, I said, Michael, you can do this thing. We do it voiceover. So if you see that whole car chase that was through the ground, if you notice, you didn't see any actors. All it was voiceover talking. That's the way you got to shoot it if you want to finish the film. Because they weren't going to let them finish the car chase. There was snow out there. And so that's, and you know, I lost a lot of contacts because of him. And he did a lot of shows and never offered me a job.
Oh, wow.
But I saved it. Yeah, I saved it for him.
I have a question to ask you. Back even when you first got started being a stuntman, did stuntmen have insurance? You know, did the studios have insurance on y'all in case you got hurt? Or,
yes,
you know,
we do. Yeah, we have.
Okay. Was it payable to y'all, or to your families, or was it payable to the studios?
No, to the families.
Yeah, okay, well, that was
good. Yeah, when you get hurt, you can sue through that. But a lot of them, some of these guys, I mean, their insurance is so high, their risk is so high, for some of them are insured to the Lords of London. At one time, they wasn't even insured. Yeah, so they insured through the Lords of London that they started, and they just keep the insurance. Yeah. But that's where we are. But, you know, I've enjoyed every minute of it, you know, and I don't have any animosity toward anybody. I don't have any animosity toward the white or the black. Like I said, the white guys did what they were supposed to do, and the blacks did what they had been conditioned to do. So that's where we were.
Yeah.
That's where we were. I understood that. And I, you know what? In fact, Reggie Park and a guy named Benny Dobbins called me into the Stuntman's Association office. I was a stuntman there. Hey, Samara.
Okay, it stopped. Okay.
Oh, go ahead.
No, it started back up again. Please, whoever has the background, please mute your line if you're not talking, because it's really coming through. It sounds like somebody's falling something. Thank you. Okay, thank you. Forgive me, Mr. Walters.
Well, I forgot where I was.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. I forgot where I was. That's just so much on my mind. You know, sometimes it just slips my mind.
Oh. You were talking about Cooley High.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had finished talking about Cooley High. You know, but Michael Schultz, I mean, and that's what he did to me. And, you know, it was a shame that you try to help people, and this is what they do to you. You know, they just go back. And when he went back and told him that I told him,
yeah,
he could have just went back and said, hey, how are we doing on this, and see if they were going to lie to him. But he went back and said, well, Marvin said that you guys are going to put a plug on me. And they told me, yes, we are.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I still saved him. I should have kept my mouth shut, but no, I'm not like that. I said, well, we can film it. We can save this. Just do it voiceover. Do the whole car chase voiceover. So that's what saved the show for him.
Well, I'm glad you saved it, that it got saved, because that is a great movie.
Yeah.
That was truly a great movie. Now, you were in Three the Hard Way. You did as a stuntman. What role did you do
Antoinette.
In that? Yes,
Antoinette.
Ma'am.
Before you go
yes,
to
ma'am.
That, I wanted to know, did he know D.C. Cameron? Because a similar thing happened to him.
Who was that?
Cooley High. G.C. Cameron.
No, I didn't know him.
He was the writer of It's So Hard to Say Goodbye, wasn't he?
Not the writer.
Okay.
He's the one that sung the song.
Oh, okay.
They came out with him on the song first, and then they took the song and gave it to the boys, whatever the name is.
Boys to Hood. I mean...
Boys the Man?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, no, I didn't know him, but you know what? It doesn't surprise me. I mean, everybody, you know, people just got, it was just bad the way that it is. But I wish these black actors would wake up and say, hey, wait a minute. I don't want a white stuntman doubling me on my show. I mean, coordinating my show, you know, because you know it's like I said, if I was Tyler Perry or anybody in that position, I would hire a white guy to come on me and train some black guys to take that position and say thank you very much. Hire in the contract, give your blacks an opportunity to work, and that's what it was. The blacks didn't have the opportunity. This is why I did what I did. Only way going to get an opportunity, you got to train them. Give them a chance to learn, because once they do, you know, I never went over budget on the show. And if you check my reputation, I got all my shots in one take. I would shoot the commercial. I mean, I would shoot the rehearsal. If I didn't get it in the rehearsal, I would get it in one take. That was my reputation. And I paid the highest set adjustments back at that time that anybody had ever received. That's how good my record was. And I'm proud of them because, you know what, when all the blaxploitation films came out, they were calling me to do them. I wouldn't do one. I went out and I studied those white guys. I studied Mickey Gilbert, Ronnie Rondell, Paul Baxley, Max. I went out and studied those guys on their shows. And I said, that's what I'm going to coordinate. And this is what I did. When I did my shows, I ran my show. I was in charge of my show. When it came to stunts, when it came to action, I was in charge. I was in the directors. They said, okay, let them be in charge. And my production managers, they said, your budget's kind of high. I said, yep, but I'm going to get it for you in one take. Because every time you do a retake, it's going to cost you another 15 minutes, and you're paying $20,000 for 15 minutes. So it saves them money.
Yeah. Well, we were speaking about Cooley High and the song and who wrote it and who now sings it and everything. So y'all don't mind, I'm going to play this for y'all. It's just a couple minutes. What the heck?
And I'll say
That was beautiful.
Oh, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Did that help refresh your memory any?
Yes,
but
yes.
But, you know, that was the part when Chief got killed. But remember Robert and Stone?
I'm sorry, Brother Kwame. Mr. Marvin was trying to say something.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I finished. I was just saying it's a beautiful song. I really enjoy working with those guys in Chicago. But that Stone guy, he was what was his name? Stone? His name was
Robert Stone. He got killed 2 years after that.
He was a real gang member.
He was a big gang member. That's right. He was a big gang member. He was in charge of the Blackstone Rangers or something like that. I forgot the name of it. Yeah, he was in charge of
Lords.
Yeah. He was in charge of the whole gang.
In real life or just in the movie?
He was real life.
Oh, wow.
He was the Vice Lords.
Yeah. Well, I remember him. He said, man, you want to go somewhere, let me know. I'll take you anywhere you want to go. You with me? I said, no, I don't want to go anywhere. I've been through that in Detroit. I said, no, thank you.
Wow.
Antoinette, excuse me. Yes. Excuse me, Antoinette.
Yes.
Hey, I just want to thank Mr. Walter's children. I was able to find out about his all the phenomenal things he's done in Hollywood. On my visit to California, I visited his son Harold and his girl Angela and JJ and Silas and Terrell. You know, when I was out in Cali, I got up on Mr. Walter, so I looked him up and I asked him if he could come for an interview. So this is like my third or fourth interview with him, and got a bunch more interviews lined up with him. So I want to thank him for his time and the information. You know, you make us proud. You know, we love what you did and we love what you still do, and you know, we'll do more work with you, sir. We sure appreciate it. Thank you so much for coming on tonight. It was beautiful.
Yes, we do.
You're very welcome, and hopefully I can get somebody to be willing to do my script. It's going, you know, get at least listen to it. So it's a hell of a script, guys. It's about a slave, but she was the most powerful woman in the Civil War. The most powerful
one. I'm not going to tell it. I'm going to let you tell it, because when you told me the story, that was really, when you gave me her background, just, you know, talking about her,
it is. I mean, she was, her name, I don't care, but like I said, you can't steal my story from me, but her name was Mary Bowser. And Mary Bowser had a photographic memory, and she worked in the White House, and she was up with a, so she was tied into the most notorious spy at that time, the Van Lewis in Richmond, Virginia. And she got her a job in the White House, in the Confederate White House. And the information that she received, because they thought she couldn't read or write, she furnished it to the Union Army. And this is how the Civil War ended. And she was she was recognized in 1995 by the United States government, you know. So anyway, it's a powerful story. It's a well-written story.
Thanks. We weren't taught.
Yeah. In Black history, people need to learn the history, you know. And I think if you learn if white folks learn Black folks' history, they realize religion didn't belong to white people. It belonged to them. So they run around talking about their Christians, but their Christianity came from Black folks. They need to wake up.
Yeah.
Black folks need to wake up, too, and understand how much power they have. We just don't understand it.
Yeah, but I truly believe that white folks know our history. The problem is they don't know their own history.
Yeah. I think they know our history better than we do.
Yeah, most definitely. That's the reason why they want to keep it a secret.
Yeah.
But
they
were so busy learning ours, they weren't taught their own. You know, they weren't taught how they were sent over here. You know, they thinking that their families that came over here were these wonderful people, and not knowing that they were the scum of the earth over there.
That's right. That's why they came over here.
Right. But they're not taught that.
Yeah. And then they came over and gave all the diseases to the Indians and tried to steal all their property.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then we were the Indians, and they don't want that known either. You know, those are things that they want to keep secret. That's the reason why they had the $5 Indians.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
you know, that they steal
everything. Excuse me. One more thing. I got to finish my shout out. I want to finish bigging up your children.
Dick.
That's okay. I just got to get this out the way. I want to finish bigging up Daria and Marcelo. Marcella. Yeah, Marcelo.
Yeah.
And Les and Gyla. I want to big up the whole crew. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. And Daria just walked in the house, so she's heard the rest of it. So
All right. That's cool.
Yeah. So, and they enjoyed it. I mean, you know, in fact, it was them who said, wait, but Dad, you talked for 2 hours. You need to set up and let them ask you some questions. He said, that's just because, you know, I can talk for 2 days and still don't get all the messages out because people don't, you know, they forget. But it's just so much information out there that they don't know that how this business got started for blacks, you know, and what the Black Stuntmen Association and the Coalition of Black Stuntmen and Women changed. The Coalition of Black Stuntmen and Women were the ones that changed Hollywood. We have more power than the NAACP. And it started with 33 of us, and it ended up with like 4 of us. But when we went to the studios, they still saw 34 people. They didn't know it was that, you know, the guys that left. And so that's why my name was recognized in Hollywood.
Yeah. See, and that's good. And, you know, just like I know one of my friends here told me years ago that one day we're going to look up and they're going to make Dr. Martin Luther King, a white man. Well, she was close.
Excuse me, don't you need to make an announcement? Are we going over?
Oh, shoot. Okay, we can. And Mr. Waters, you can stay with us as long as you're able to. But, folks, we have 4 minutes. Forgive me. We have 4 minutes left in this live program. The call-in number is area code 626-414-3504. Again, that's area code 626-414-3504. And we also have, no, unfortunately, does anyone have the other call-in number up? If not, it's going to take me a minute. But you have to call in now if you wish to still be a part of the show, if you have a question or a comment. The other number is area code 515-605-9343. Again, that's area code 515-605-9343. And press the number 1 if you have a question or a comment. Thank you. And thank you, Ms. Kim. Ms. Kim? Okay, I wanted to make sure I was still there.
You're welcome.
I'm looking forward to meeting you, Ms. Kim. I need to come back and make another trip back to Detroit just so we can sit down and talk.
Absolutely, but I'm trying to get to Galveston.
Well, hey, come on. Come on to Galveston. Dude, come on to Galveston. I love it. I tell you, I love it. I love the majority of the people.
Mr. Walters.
Yes.
You're in Galveston?
Yeah, well, I'm in Texas City. I'm 15 miles from Galveston and 28 miles from Houston.
Yeah, I used to live in Galveston. Yeah, because I used to live right there on 1765, and I worked at Danforth Hospital in Galveston.
At what hospital?
Danforth.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm just off of 1765, really. But I'm in a new subdivision. We had this house built 26 years ago. When we moved out here, there were hardly any houses out here at all. Now we're surrounded by houses, so that's
the
way it goes.
I was there in 1979.
Well, I didn't come here until 1989. 1989, I came out to do it a movie. When I got off the plane, I said, that's it. I'm not going back to California. And they said, why? I said, peace of mind. I got peace of mind out here. They said, you're going to give them all that money? I said, yeah. They couldn't believe it. The same guys were coming. I said, no, I don't want to come back there. They could not believe it. I said, no. So I enjoyed it.
So you ever visit the Moody? Have you visited
Moody?
The Moody Pyramids?
Oh yeah, in fact, that's what we did. Our film festival, excuse me, was held at the Moody Moody Gardens. Yeah, I visited there quite often. But they allowed us to do our film festival there last year, and they were going to let us do it this year. It got, you know, with the pandemic, that took care of that. But they said they're going to try to do it next year.
Right, but the Moody Pyramids, there's three glass, crystal glass pyramids.
Right.
And they're directly on the same 29.6 latitude. You could draw a straight line, and you would hit the three pyramids of Giza. Well, the four pyramids, not because they just opened up on Easter Sunday. They opened up the fourth pyramid monument, the Great Pyramid Museum.
That's interesting. When you talk about pyramids, because you know the first stone pyramid known to man was created by a little black man named Imhotep. That pyramid.
He was the king. He was advisor for King Djoser. He was a multi-genius. He was also a physician, a gastrologist, and he designed the step pyramids.
Some of the surgical instruments used today were invented by him, and they got a statue of this little black man out of UTMB, University of Texas Medical Branch, along with some other notables. But he's out there.
Right,
a little black man.
That's what the Hippocratic, what's his name, Herodotus, studied and said.
Yeah.
That's who taught him.
So we just have so much about history we don't know.
Yes, that is so true. Let me remind y'all, if you have a question or a comment, please press the number 1 and we can open your line so that you're able to make your statement or ask your question.
You got me for another 20 minutes, so if you want to ask some questions, you better ask them. I appreciate you asking some.
Now, you worked on Cooley High. You worked as a stuntman on Cooley High. Okay.
Yeah.
Because that high school, that was Finger High School, well, it used to be Finger High School, and Cabrini Green there, and you're talking about Egypt, and there's a student that came out of there, a brother named Tony Browder. He wrote, Nile Valley Civilization. Him and his daughter have written extensively on Egypt, and they're now excavating as Asa Hilliard archaeologist site there in Egypt right now. And, you know, it's funny how here this guy came out of the projects in Cabrini Green, and now he's an archaeologist. He lives in D.C., but he does archaeology work there in D.C., I mean in Egypt.
Yep. That's the home. Our first civilization was there.
Well, we came from the mountain of the moon, as you said, in the papyrus, the papyrus of Hunefer, and that's what that comes from, that the people came. But Tanzania, and that's the same, Omo Valley is the same area where they found Denkwesh, or the oldest remains of what they call Lucy, 3.5 billion years. Right, and she came from that same area when Leakey, the African brought her bones in and gave them to Leakey while he was playing Lucy in the Sky, and that's why he called her Lucy, because they were playing the song of the Beatles.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Mr. Walters, do you think it would be advantageous to have workshops or stunts in the black community?
Not anymore, because most of the stunts are now being done on computers. But it would be nice if you can get, it would be nice just to learn the techniques, because learning the techniques of the doing of stunts will keep you in pretty good shape. You know, because I mean, you learn how to fall, you learn how to throw punches, you learn how to do left shoulder rolls, right shoulder low roll, how to hit the ground, and so the practice will keep you in pretty good shape.
It also increase everything, because they have to, the timing and all of that's involved, right?
Yes. Oh, yes, definitely. Yes, the timing is there. It'll teach you a lot about camera angles, you know. But, I look at some of these shows today, and I see a lot of people getting hurt because these new directors don't know anything about camera angles, you know. And the stunt coordinators don't know anything about camera angles or camera lenses, how you can change the camera lens, and, you know. This is how I got hurt on Jason's Lyric. I got hurt in 1993 during Jason's Lyric. Got hurt on the 22nd of October, and had for 2 or 3 years I didn't work because I was in so much pain they couldn't find out where the pain was coming from. And then in 1996, a doctor came over from England and discovered that my pedicle C12 had to be removed, which holds my rib. So it's gone. And by that time, I was basically out of the business because out of sight, out of mind. I couldn't work. It was painful all the time.
Now, could I ask the question, like they're using green screens now where they computerize stunts, and what they'll do is they'll hook the person up to the wiring if he's going to do some kind of flying event. And that part
right.
of that stunning, those stuntmen are, and really they're not really doing anything because all of the other is added into it by
right.
editing or however they do it now with technology.
Yeah, that's what they do. And in fact, right now, my wife, I noticed she belongs to a group called the Lynx Incorporated, and they were doing a town hall. And they got this thing set up where they can, it's amazing what they can do with screens. They can create backgrounds for themselves now and have a back. I said, whoa, I didn't know all that. Yeah, it's amazing what they do with these computers. You see a whole lot of places and you say, wow, I just wonder where that place is. It doesn't even exist. It does not exist because it's all been done on screen nowadays.
And you were talking about Spielberg and James when they were riding in the motel. And the part about Spielberg, Spielberg, where he started using Apple product, and he was doing like Star Wars and all of that, was a lot of it was done through computers. It's animation that they be able to make massive amount of soldiers, and you think all of these extras are in there, and it's just a repeat of how they've been able to program the computer to make all of these individuals look like a lot of people when it's only really a few.
That's right. Yeah, that's what they do. That's what they do. So but that's the way it is in the business now. So the stunt people, they still have a lot of stunt people, but I wouldn't suggest people getting into it right now, unless the black actors start sticking up for them and, you know, demanding that they have blacks on their shows. But most of these shows you watch nowadays were black actors. All the stunt people are white. All the stunt people. I mean, we were doing an episode of Hardy Boys, and that's the director. And we were in Russia. So I asked the director, I said, hey, man, can I put a couple of black guys in the car over there? He said, oh, sure. He said, hell, if they want to know, they might have some blacks in Russia. Yeah, put them in the car. So I got work for two black guys. Put them in the car. You know, that's two steps, man. Put them in the car. But a lot of it depends on how much the director's respected you. Because I've had directors tell me, oh, well,
two directors tell, well, a black person wouldn't do that. I said, how in the hell are you going to tell me? I said, just like, how in the hell are you going to tell me what a black person would do? You ever been black? You know, so, and that's the way I talk to them.
But you were saying about Tyler Perry, because I'm here while I'm in Eatonton. I'm in the birthplace where Alice Walker was born at, but I'm not far from Atlanta. And with Tyler Perry Studios opening up, and then there's a lot of other studios that are beginning to crop up, and they're beginning, this is supposed to be the Black Hollywood now. And look, with all of these different studios, I don't know the industry that might, well, but would you say, would that be something where black stunt people would be able to go in and apply to work there as far as being a part of the association?
Well, no, see, the stunt people don't work like that. Stunt people apply for jobs. What happens is a stunt coordinator, they hire a stunt coordinator. Now, I also don't know how many black stunt coordinators he's hired, because I haven't followed him that much, but I see a lot. He has a lot of black people on his show, but I understand a lot of his crew are white, but maybe because he couldn't find, but I don't know what it is. So I really can't say that much about Tyler Perry. I can say one thing. I'm just proud of the man where he came from, you know, and what he did.
Right.
And so I got to be proud of him for that. Like, so I can't say anything about him, but I can say, you know, Denzel Washington and what's his name, Beverly Hills, whatever. Those guys, you know, they don't care who do they show. They don't demand, you know, blacks. They should say, hey, I want a black guy. Like Cosby said, I want a black. This is what I want. You know, but a lot of them don't do that. Sidney Poitier was the same way. He wants a black. You know, but these guys, they don't care. Ice Cube, he always got white stunt coordinators on his show. You know, Denzel Washington, I think, just lately started using them on blacks on his show. And
but
Bad Boys Forever.
Right. But
Bad
you
Boys
came up in
white
the
coordinator. I'm sorry.
Did you ever get to meet Gordon Parks?
Yes, I worked on. I did tests with Gordon for Gordon Parks.
Okay.
Yeah, because he was a director test. Now, that's an incident. A white guy hired me because a white guy in California called a white guy in New York, Alex Stevens, who I didn't know. I didn't know Alex, but this guy. Yeah, Joe Pronto, I knew him in California. So he said, man, you got to hire this guy, Marvin Walsh. So Alex called me to come down to New York. I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks. Just a double Richard Roundtree. But when I got down there, this kid, Alex, he'd been doing a lot of shows in New York. He didn't have anything set up. He didn't know. I said, man, we got to get a camera. We got to go out and film and shoot these locations. And next thing I know, they had me down as a stunt coordinator. I wasn't trying to take his job, but I said, let's do it right. You know, he was out there. You got to see from your locations. You got to know where the cars are coming from. And those guys at that time, they just went out and winged it. But he was from New York, and they didn't have that many stunt coordinators back there, you know. He just worked a lot of shows back there. But as far as the stunt coordinator, I don't know if this was his first show or not. But he didn't know how to. But he gave me a big break down there. I got down in. I even broke the script down for Cooley High. And I broke the script down for Cooley High. They wanted me to do the show. But then this guy named Ralph came in. And Ralph Serpy, he liked black girls. So he was being furnished. The guy, the stunt coordinator on the show, used to furnish him with black girls with all the shows that he did. So I didn't play that game. anyway, he got the show. I was okay, that's the way it goes sometime, I guess. I'd be on the show and I see a white guy I was working at Universal, and this white guy patted this black girl on her butt. She just giggled. I said, no, you won't be back tomorrow. I talked to the people and he was gone. He didn't come back. They got rid of him. I said, no, you don't do that. And then they think it's funny. You know, I said, I said, why did you do that? Well, she said, I need to work. I said, okay. I can understand that, I guess. Let somebody pet you on the butt and you're going to giggle about it.
So that's where we are.
Well, I'm grateful.
Is there anything that you wish you would have done differently?
Pardon?
If you had to do it over, again, is there anything that you wish that you would have done differently?
Yes, I wish I was more diplomatic. I sat in a movie at MGM Studios and told the president, one of the vice presidents, that he was a lie in front of everybody else. And that's when Alex Scott,
wow,
black director, he called me up and said, "Marvin, you don't tell me you're lying." He said, I understood you to say. I said, "Well," I said, "okay." Now, I mean, I would just confront you. Yeah, to me, the only way I could come to you, that's what I learned in Detroit. You got to be coming face to face, you know. But then I learned later on that if I'd have been more diplomatic, I probably could have got a lot more jobs for people. But, you know, but I don't know. I can't say for sure, but I'd be more diplomatic. I wouldn't tell somebody that they were lying, you know. And I would go a different route. Because when I was out there by myself, basically, and me and J.D. David, you know, because she was a black stunt girl, and she was working just about every day. And she took the cell, she gave it up to work with, you know, came to work with MGM with me. And we changed MGM because we put all the statistics, and we gave, didn't know what to do. They were shocked when they saw that. When they saw their own reports, they were shocked. And we would get letters from the government. They would come to me, to Marvin Walters. I said, "What?" Yeah, so we made a lot of changes in Hollywood. In Hollywood, I could call any studio and get interviews. I was able to talk to the chairman of the board of the studios. But I respected them, and they respected me. That's what it was all about.
Yeah, and that was good. Now. We know how the black man came in into being able to do the stunt, to become a stuntman. How did the way open up for women to come in? Was there a certain woman, or was it just, you know, just everything you've done alone?
No, they had women out there too. But the thing is, when I went to Universal, I hired those five stunt women, those five young ladies, and they would be stunt women.
Yeah,
that opened it up for them. Now you got a whole. You got two black stunt women out there coordinating shows today. Two black young black ladies coordinating shows. Yep. Yes, ma'am.
Now I know you saying black men and black women. I know that wrestling has gotten to be popular, the MMA, you know, all of this big wrestling mania and all of this. Do they use people to teach them how to do their stunts, because all of it is not real?
No, you know Booker T? You remember Booker T? The wrestler Booker T?
Yeah.
Did you know him? Well, he has a gym right around the corner from me, and he teaches people how to wrestle. His wife used to be a wrestler. She used to wrestle also. I forget what her name was when she wrestled, but her and my wife belong to the same organization, and two organizations together. One is Jack and Jill Nevels, the Lynx Incorporated. They belong to those together. So yeah, he right around the corner. He has a big place over there now, and he teaches kids how to wrestle, you know, the tricks to it. Yeah, most of it is they're stunt people. That's all they are, really. They are stunt people.
Yeah, that's why I was asking the question, because a lot of it is what stunt people do in acting out, you know, the fight scenes and knowing how to fall, how to take punches, how to, you know, get hit with objects and do all those different things to make it look so real for the audience while they're in the auditorium watching the wrestling matches.
Yeah. Well, that's what I said. You know, nowadays you get so many kids hurt out there doing stunts nowadays. I mean, because they don't know camera angles and they don't know camera lenses. The lens makes a big difference when you're doing a fight. You know, rather than use the two actors, you want to use two stunt people to double the actors. You know, and then you just change the lens on the camera and you shoot them just like the other, and you don't know the difference if you do your cuts in and out. You know, the master should be done by the stunt guys, and you bring the actors in to do the close-ups and the cuts, you know, and that's the way it should work. But these young kids, they don't know that. And actually kids getting,
some of these kids getting thrown up against the wall and all that. That's crazy. I said, God, only give me a break here. But they want to make the money, I guess. I mean, these guys, they're making $200 a year, $300,000 a year, 18, 19-year-old kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me make this again. If you have a question or a comment, just press the number one and we can open you up so you can ask your questions or make your comments. Okay, forgive me for cutting the cost, y'all.
No, I wanted to find out because what we have now is a lot of violence that we're seeing, like, you know, Boys in the Hood, the gangster type movies of black on black crime. In that, is that stunt people used in that those shots when they do the different shootings and the whole situations?
A lot of times they are. Depends on what the person is doing. Sometimes if the actor is just going to get shot and do it and fall up against the wall, they might use the actor. But if he's going to hit the ground, it depends on how violent they want it. Did you see? What the hell was that? Jason's lyric.
Yes, I did.
Jason's lyric. Okay. That was me on the floor when Bokeem Woodbine came in and pulled me up, picked me up off the floor, and went to take my watch when he came in late. They cut this so bad, but we did it 15 times. He hit me in the face with the gun. He kicked me in the ribs. They cut all that scene out. Oh. And I told the director from the beginning, I said, well, we need to get a stunt double for this guy. Oh, no, I'm not. I want to see his face. I said, okay. So I knew I was going to get hurt, but not that bad. I didn't know I was going to get hurt enough to be out of the business for 3 years because stunt people are very important. But see, I don't blame the actor because when I'm out there, my job is to protect the other stunt person or to protect the actor. Actors are out there, the stunt person, he's thinking the same thing. He wants to protect me. But an actor's out there, he's thinking about how he looks on camera. He's thinking about his lines. He's thinking about a whole lot of different things. He's not thinking about stunts. You know, that's the furthest thing from his mind. And so he hit me in the face.
No. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, you know, so I got hit in the gun. I got kicked in the ribs. We did it 15 times. I was hurt the first time. But the thing is, when you're out there playing, you play. Now I'm not playing. I'm playing a role. I'm doing a stunt, but I'm playing a role as a stuntman. I'm not doubling somebody else. So since I'm playing a role, if I get hurt, I gotta stay there because there's nobody doubling me. You know, so. Yeah, so we did it 15 times, and I said, oh, man. I mean, you made $5,000 for the night, but hey, look at me, I was hurt for 3 years, you know. But that's the way it is. There's a lot of money. Huh?
I'm sorry, I cut across you again. I'm sorry, forgive me. Now, what I want to know, do you think that art is portraying life, or is life portraying art? Now, the violence that we're seeing in the movies, is that because of what's being portrayed out in the street, or is that contributing to the violence that's in the street, in your opinion?
You know what? I've never even given that any thought because, I mean, I see violence in the street. I see some of the violence I see on television shouldn't even be there. You know, I see a lot of unnecessary stunts. You know, I mean, if you guys look at some that I coordinated, you want – the stunts that I did on my shows were always, you'll find that they were always a part of the scene. You look at some of the shows that I stunt coordinated, and I didn't do stunts for stunt's sake. I had to have a reason for doing a stunt. I had to have a reason for a guy getting hit by a car, not just because I want to see him get hit by a car, you know. So that was just me, though. But, you know, it's different strokes with different folks.
Yeah, that's true.
And like I said, I was fortunate enough to be able to, I took my time. I went out and I studied those white stunt coordinators. These were the best guys, the stunt coordinators in the business at that time. Mickey Gibble was the guy who trained me. So when I wasn't working on the show, I would go out and watch him. I'd go out to Max Kevin, Paul Baxter. You look at these guys' names up there, some big stunt coordinators. And I went out and studied them. I studied them. And then when I came in to decide to do a show, I knew exactly what I was doing.
Right. The movie The Matrix, And they were showing how they were making that. They did one scene, I think it was Matrix, one of the second Matrix, where they were out on, they had to build because they couldn't use the expressway because it was too crowded to film what they wanted. So they had to build an expressway set in order to do the chase scenes and the automobile crashes and the whole blow up of whatever they did. And they were showing how they had to stunt to set up that they have people that are stunt drivers that know how
right.
to flip a car, how to make a car, you know, do what they want to do in the movie. And I'm asking, is that something that, you know, as stunt men, do you have a variety, or do you do fight scenes, or do you do,
I did everything. I said everything but motorcycles. But see, there's when you're doing car stunts, there's a trick to car stunts, because your tires are, depending on what you're doing, your tires could be, you may have two tires inflated to 60 or 70 and two tires inflated to 25, you know. So it's knowing what you're doing with the car. And, you know, so it's not just getting out there, taking a car, and what you see, it doesn't work that way. It takes the inflation of the tires and knowing how to use the emergency brake. So it's a lot to it. It is going to get out there. And like you see these kids out there, some damn people doing donuts out in the street nowadays, kids.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that in the movies. I mean, you know, the movies is, you know, you got to be really careful, because when you're out there, you could kill somebody. We got so many people. When we were doing CS Explorer, we had a car chase. And I was driving a red, I think it was a Plymouth, and Alex Stevens was driving a green Mustang, 68 Mustang. So during the rehearsal, we came over the hill, and, you know, came down. There was a cameraman right in the middle of the street. And I said, no, can't move that camera. Oh, man, I said, I'm not going to do it. I will not do this thing with him in the middle of the street. So he was pissed off. I said, tie the camera off. So they tied the camera off. When we came over that hill, Alex Stevens' car wheel, the front wheel came up and ran right through the camera. The guy would have been dead.
Oh, my goodness.
Dead. Yeah, it's a safety thing. You can't let these directors. You know, when I'm doing stunts, and I'm basically the director, even if I'm not, you know, director of the second unit. But when you're doing stunts, if I'm the coordinator, it's my responsibility to make sure everything. And I do that, you know. If you don't want to do it, I'll quit the show. I mean, people thought I was crazy, I guess.
No, but it's a good thing that you knew what you were doing, even if they didn't.
Well, that's the key to it. You know, but a lot of kids, they don't learn the business. They think because they can go out. I mean, there's a difference between a stuntman and a daredevil. And most of these stunts, kids, they are daredevils. They're not stunt people because they don't train for it. They don't know it because there's nobody to train them. When I got into the business, you had to be trained by a stunt coordinator. That's how you got into the business, being trained by a stunt coordinator.
Yeah, see, that was going to be my school or anything that stuntmen go to, but you said they had to be trained, so that's good. Now, unfortunately, the young people that are out in the streets today that are doing all of this stuff, they're not getting trained in. They think that they can do the car scenes like they see on television, and they don't know that it's a procedure that's done before the stunt is even done.
It is. Yep, you got to inflate those tires a certain way depending on what stunt you're going to do and how you're going to do it. And sometimes you have to put water out of the street depending to get a certain kind of stunt. But that's the way it works.
Yeah, but see, y'all are so good at it that you make it, you know, just seem so natural that, you know, no one would know that it's all these procedures that are done beforehand.
You know, I think the best car man in the business today, or one of the best, is Henry Kinsey. Henry Kinsey, he was a member of the Black Stuntmen's Association. They didn't want him in the association because he's light-skinned, and he's really light-skinned K.I. They didn't want him in. Mm-hmm. But Ernie Robinson, who bought him. So being Ernie Robinson thought to get him into the business. Henry Kinsey got him working with Paul Baxley, one of the best stunt coordinators. And Henry's got to be worth a multimillionaire. Because he's working on all these shows.
you know. But I put him in his first car, and I taught him. I said, you do a 180 this way, you do a Brody, and you do a 90. And he's one of the best car guys out there. But according to him, I was never. Yeah, but according to him, I was never a member of the BSA. I'm telling you, I designed both the logos for the Stemmen Association. The first one was the Negro Stemmen Association. I designed that logo. Then when we came to BSA, Black Stemmen Association, I was doing a show at Uptight in Cleveland, Ohio. And Eddie Smith called me and said, hey, man, 2 days after Martin Luther King was killed, I said, we want to change the name to the Black Stemmen Association. I said, fine, go ahead and do it. Then I came back and I designed the logo for the Black Stemmen Association. So we got two logos, one the Negro Stemmen Association and one was the Black Stemmen Association. But then they said, I didn't do that. So, I mean, we went to court over that. We had a big battle over that. I had to take them to court. So anyway, they can do what they want with the label and I can do whatever I want with the label. So, you know. But that's the way it was.
Yeah,
it's
the same.
You got some guys in the picture that were. He was telling about the picture. Those three of the guys were never in the Black Stemmen's Association, but their pictures are there. And I was in the Stemmen's Association. My picture's not in that book. I was in the Black Stemmen's Association. My picture's not in that book. JD and I designed the book for minority stem players, all the minority stem players, all minorities. It was Hispanics, Chinese, or whatever. My picture's not in that book. I never was the one for taking pictures. That just was not me. That just was not me. Like I said, you come to my house today, you'll find three pictures. That's it. And those three pictures are people that I respected.
Yeah. So, it's truly
right,
unfortunate.
Guys. I think I'm going to give you 10 more minutes, and I'm going to have to go because it's 10:30. 10 more minutes. How's that? Is that good enough?
And that's fine. I appreciate the time that you've already afforded us. I truly appreciate it. And I just want to thank you, again, for being with us. And, if anybody has a question, you better get it in quickly. So if you press 1, then I can let you in real quick. If not, then we're going to thank Mr. Waters for his time and welcome him to come back at any time that you so desire. We welcome you back. Just give me a call.
I don't think I have with this. I don't think there would be anything else I could say. I mean, there's so much I could say, but you know what?
When you go to make your movie, you got to come back then and let us know that your movie's coming out.
Well, I hope there's somebody listening to your show that's interested in it. Say, okay, let's talk about this.
I hope so, too. Yes.
That's the way it is. You never know. But somebody might be looking for a script. But that's the way it is. It's a dynamite script. It's well written. I mean, Nima Burnett, she's a big time director, and she read the script. She's marvelous, really. But I don't have time to do it because I got three projects of my own I'm trying to do. I said, okay, I can understand that.
Yeah. Well,
but if you land on the right person's Right, but what I'm asking is that he has the script and he has already seen the vision of who would you like to see the actress to play that part?
Well, you know what? I've got a list of actresses. I really like to see Viola Davis play it, I really don't have a preference. I've learned a long time ago, if you're going to get the script read, if I'm gonna produce it and direct it, or do a co-production on it, then I would say, now I've got a director, man, that I'd like to see do it. But as far as the actresses and things, I don't have any idea. But the script is well enough, written well enough to know if somebody want to do it, if they want to read it, I'll send it to their agent and let them read it and see if they're interested in doing it because it's a very good script. And it's going to take a powerful actress to do it.
Yeah, the reason I was asking that, because the young girl that played Billie Holiday in U.S. versus that, they didn't think that she was fit for the role, but somehow or the other the creator knew better and put her in there, and she said that her spirit was taken by Billie Holiday, and this is why she was able to perform the way she did in the movie.
Well, I can believe that. I can believe that. Because, you know, you got a lot of method actors out there. And you know, when I worked with Cicely Tyson when we were doing River Niger, every time night mm-hmm. after we got off, we finished work, I would take her out to a cancer place up in Beverly Hills. She went out to a cancer place just about every night, learned how to be a cancer victim, you know, patient, being a cancer patient. Oh, yeah, that's why she was so good. You know, and there was a few actors out there like that. It was, you know, they just didn't take the role, but they studied, you know, they really studied what they were doing, you know. And so, yeah.
That person, wow.
You have to, you know, if that's your job.
Yeah, and Lou Gossett and James Earl Ray, James Earl Jones, right.
Yeah.
They both played that part, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Lou and I go back a long way. We go back to like 1960s, 68, when he was doing a show on the Mod Squad, and I doubled him on that show. So we go back a long way, too.
Right.
He quit the show. He didn't want to do it anymore. They wanted to do it. He didn't want to do it. Yeah, he didn't get fired. He didn't cancel the show. He quit the show. He didn't want to do it anymore. I don't know why, but he didn't want to do it.
So that's what happened.
Yeah, he quit the show. They didn't fire him. He quit. He said he didn't want to do it anymore. Right.
The show went down after that.
Huh?
Yeah. What was her name? Played Lieutenant Uhuru on Star Trek. And she said in her biography she was getting ready to quit. And she was at an NAACP dinner. And one of the people at the table says, "We got somebody that's a Trekkie that would like to meet you," and really wanted to meet her. And when she turned around and looked, Dr. King was standing there and said that he was really proud of her because she was bringing the black woman to television, and he was really, you know, for her playing that role, gave young black women a new identity.
Well, you know, I'm gonna say this. This young white lady that I was telling you about, who Clarence Thomas appointed to take care of the
Peggy Lipton.
Peggy Lipton was that. Yeah, that was on my squad. But I'm telling you, that was the EEOC charges. When Warner Brothers violated, Warner Brothers and Quinn Martin violated the EEOC charges, I mean the settlement agreement, Clarence Thomas appointed this young white girl to come out into the movie business. She said, and I have a letter from her where she said, Barack Obama was elected president because of the coalition of black stuntmen and women, because we demanded to have blacks on the television, and they saw a black person on black president on TV. That's why she thinks he was elected, or a black person. They believed it. Oh, we fought for that. We fought for blacks to be on television in meaningful roles. We didn't want to see Showtime boys. We didn't want to see Porters. Not just Showtime boys and Porters. We didn't want to see just that on TV and maids. We fought to change change all that. It wasn't easy, but we got it done.
Yes. And we do have a caller for you now. If you're ready, we'll take this caller.
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay. Area code 336. Area code 336. Okay. Hello, Sister Parrish.
Yes. Thank you so much for taking my call. This is so inspiring to me, everybody. I mean, thank you, sir, for just coming to the planet and being able to do what you do and what you did and what you're still doing. I am just so grateful that I'm in this lifetime to hear this. It just really is kind of overwhelming, you know, because you never, as a youngster, which I'm not anymore, you never realize when you're watching these movies, these films, what goes into it, the people that are behind it, that are making, opening doors for the young people. So I'm just grateful to be on the planet and able to hear this. And thank you, Sister Antoinette. And thank you, Brother Kwame, for the research that you do. And just thank you. Thank us. And that's all that I... Oh, Miss Kim, I really do need to have a reasoning with you. It's very important, ma'am. It really is. So thank us. And
well,
thank you.
Thank you, Sister.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, you know, I do what I do. I've been pronounced dead 4 times. So,
oh, no.
Yeah. You know.
We're glad that you're still amongst the living.
I don't know. I keep telling God to take me away. The last time was I was watching my son here in Texas City. Out here, he was playing, he was practicing football. And I was sitting there with my daughter. We were sitting in the car watching practice. And this was in 2011. And I found myself waiting around with paramedics. And they're saying, oh, the Black Widow said, he was dead. You know, God's not ready for me yet, so I don't know. I guess I have.
Yeah, for a reason.
I wouldn't have met you on the phone if you'd have been gone.
Well,
did you hear me, Antoinette?
Yes, ma'am.
See, so when you're talking about coming to Detroit, I keep telling them that Detroit is so much different now. But I think God sent me here to share some of the love that I received as a child in Black Bottom. They have nothing like that now.
No, you're right. Black Bottom was the most unique place I have ever been in. I've been, I've worked in several countries, and Black Bottom is still the unique place for me. But Black Bottom isn't Black Bottom since they come in and tore it down and put all those doggone, the whole South Side they tore down. I won't know what that hurt. That hurt because we had communities. I mean, we have relationships.
Real
neighborhood. Yeah, yeah, you know. And but this is why they did it. They had to break it up.
Right.
They had to break it up. And they did a good job of it.
But
yeah,
New Orleans thing about it.
Hey, let me ask a question. Have any of you ever heard of the Willie Lynch speech? The Willie Lynch syndrome?
Yes.
You know what?
Yes,
it came out. They say it came out in like 1972 or something. My wife
came out.
Mrs. Mac. Huh?
No, I was saying December 1712.
Yeah. No, I'm telling them. Yeah. But Mrs. Magney taught me about the Willie Lynch syndrome in 1948 when I first met her. A white teacher was telling me about the Willie Lynch syndrome. Now people say, oh, that's just something somebody created that story in 1980s and 1970s. I said, no, I know about it a lot. This is why I did what I did. That's why I did exactly what I did in the Ocean Picture business. I understood that. I understood exactly what they're saying. The slave, the house nigger will hate the field nigger. The light skin will hate the dark skin. The old hate the young. And I understood that exactly. This has got to change.
Yes,
it came out as it's Let's Make a Slave. That's what originally it was written as. And then they put the Willie Lynch
part in there, but it was called Let's Make a Slave.
Yeah. So that's where we are.
Yeah. Well, you know what, y'all? We have 15 minutes left. And, Mr. Waters, I know we've already took your 10 minutes. But, you know, again, we want to thank you for being with us. And if you have any closing remarks, we'd like to give you this time so that you can make them.
My closing remarks is love, love, love your people. Love yourself first,
yes.
And love your people. And understand what has happened to us. Understand why we do what we do. And you can't, you know, that's the way I'm saying, how could I be mad at the Black Sun Gassels for what they have done to me? I'm not angry with them because I understood why they did it.
Yes.
I understand why they did it. In fact, one of the biggest ones right now did it to me. He had cancer, and I called him the other day. I mean, because he had COVID. They thought he was going to die, and I called and said, hey, man. No, he was surprised that I called him. I don't have time to hate. Hate is like a cancer. It'll eat you up inside.
Yes,
but
it will.
Anyway,
it must really be something about the town that you and Miss Kim came from, because she says the same thing, that she doesn't hate anyone, even the ones that, you know, did her wrong and stuff like that. She still says, you know, the only thing I can do is love them. And you're saying
that's
the same thing, so it must be something about y'all's town. That must be just what was bred in y'all.
You gotta love them, because. Hey Kim, let me ask you a question. Do you remember chew tobacco?
Yes, I do. I didn't do it, but yes, I remember.
He was a detective. Chew tobacco was a detective. It was three detectives and one police officer. They used to ride around in this 1948 Buick. They'd catch you out at night and make you push. The Big Four came after that. This was before the Big Four.
It did?
The Big Four.
You remember Ben Turpin?
Oh, yeah, I remember Ben Turpin. Yes, very well. Yeah. I remember Ben Turpin at the Carver Theater, too.
The Carver Theater.
Yeah. I remember Ben Turpin. But I'm just saying, you know, it was very intuitive. He would spit tobacco on you. He was a mean SOB. And that's me and my brother were buying. We went to the auction. We were buying a bike at the auction. You know, the bike was 75 cents, and we were pushing the bike down the stairs. And Chew Tobacco was coming up the stairs, and Ben Turpin was behind us. And Chew Tobacco pushed my brother out. Pushed him aside, and Ben Turpin pushed his ass down the stairs. And Ben Turpin was big black.
He put Chew Tobacco on your butt.
He pushed Chew Tobacco down the stairs. Sure did. Pushed him down the stairs. And I said,
I was going to ask you to give them your impression of Ben Turpin.
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
I wanted you to tell them something about Ben Turpin.
Oh, Ben Turpin. He had this old 1936 car, whatever it was. He had two guns on his side, and he was big and black. And there was a time I was on 8 Mile Road. They had a gang on 8 Mile Road. I forgot what it was called. And so they said, Ben Turpin, well, we want you to go out there and break this gang up, because it was black. And he said, they said, well, how many gap men do you need? Ben Turpin said, how many gangs is it? He said, one gang. He said, I don't need anybody else. He was something else in the neighborhood. He was something else. I've heard some positive things about him. I've heard some negative things. Well, I can go from what I have seen. It was all positive. That's what I've seen. Because he used to come by my house, you know. So I don't know, you know. Ben Turpin got they had the summer camp, and Ben Turpin got a white cop named Officer Leo, brought him by the house and said, I want you to get this boy in the summer camp. He got me in that summer camp, a white guy. I said, whoa, how about that? So there was some interesting things going on in my life.
I think that because he was in the neighborhood, that had a lot to do with it, because when people saw him, when they saw his car, they straightened up if they wasn't.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. They sure did. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, it's been a pleasure. I'm glad to be able to talk with all of you. It is now 10:48, and it's time for me to get off of this show, and I'll be glad, you know, like I said, there's so much I can talk about in this business, you know, that it might be better next time. If I ever come to again, what I'm going to do is just read the chronological history from 1967 all the way up to 1982. I'm just going to read it. Go from there. There, here it is.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Can I ask one last question? One last question. When you left Detroit, where did you go and what did you do?
I left Detroit. I went into the Army. I left Detroit and went straight into the Army. I said, I got to get out of Detroit. Then when I got out of the Army, I moved to California. I went to California. I said, no, Detroit's not for me. I love Detroit more now than I did then. When I saw Detroit, I said, I can't live like this. Especially when they tore all the neighborhoods, all the houses down, broke the community up, and I had to move to the projects. I said, I don't want that. I didn't know what a project was until they tore all of our houses down, condemned all of our homes, and we had to move out to the projects. I said, no, this is not what I want. So I went to the Army.
What year was that?
1954.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, God bless you. Thank you so much, Angela.
Thank all of you, and I appreciate it. Glad to talk to you. We'll talk to you later, hopefully.
God bless.
And we're gonna play Miss Kim's song out a little more low.
Okay, good.
While we sit in the show, whenever you see me cry, laugh it all when I tell a little lie. Oh, just ignore whenever I say goodbye. But you see, I'm on just a little more love, a little more love, a little more love, a little more love. Make me know you're mine. When I get a call, you got to take me out when I want to have a ball. You've got to like my friend, but think I'm the best of all, cause I want a little more.
Okay, well, thank y'all for being with us tonight. I will be back on tomorrow night at 9 o'clock. I have a guest with me, Brother Asa. And don't forget Dry Bones on Sunday at 10 a.m. for the Helios Filios. So thank you all for coming. And, again, Mr. Walters, thank you for being with us. And everyone else, Ms. Kim. I'm sorry, go ahead, Ms. Walters.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. And, you know, again, you're welcome back at any time. Just give me a call and you're on.
Good
so
night.
Thank you and y'all. Good night. Good night, everyone. Have a good evening.